train.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
As the AARP gears up to spend more than $5 million to oppose plans by the Bush administration to begin privatizing Social Security, Karl Rove is stepping up to shape the president's public relations campaign. According to the Washington Post, Rove, with the help of White House official Charles P. Blumhouse, plans to raise anywhere from $50 million to $100 million to convince the American people that the president's Social Security initiative needs to be enacted. The new plan would allow younger workers to invest part of their Social Security contribution into the stock market. Then NAACP, AFL-CIO, and National Organization of Women have all said they oppose plans to privatize Social Security and are coordinating with Democratic leaders in Congress. On the other side of the aisle, conservative groups like Club for Growth and Progress for America are raising funds alongside corporate trade associations like the National Association of Manufacturers. Many corporations that support privatization have already begun sending money to a group called the Alliance for Worker Retirement Security. Bush is expected to go public with his plans later this month. The coming Social Security fight will be one of the biggest public policy battles in years.
The Republican-dominated National Labor Relations Board has issued a string of rulings tilting in favor of employers over workers. The decisions have made it more difficult for temporary workers to organize unions and have made it easier for employers to use lockouts against workers, among other things. These decisions have been party-line votes, with Republicans opposing the positions taken by workers. Cornell professor James Gross, an author of several books about the NLRB, says these decisions are fundamentally inconsistent with the purpose of the NLRB, which is to encourage collective bargaining.
The union representing police officers in Orlando, Florida, filed a lawsuit against that city's mayor last week, demanding records of his travel expenses and cell phone usage. The officers, represented by the Fraternal Order of Police, are currently involved in bitter contract negotiations with Mayor Buddy Dyer and are demanding his public records to seek out any wrongdoing. The police union has also taken the fight to the sky, flying a banner behind a plane during the Citrus Bowl parade that said, "Mayor Dyer, show police your public record. It's the law." According to the mayor's office, the records have been available for review for months, but no one from the union had asked if they were done. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Employers gave workers less paid holidays in 2004 than in recent years. With both Christmas and New Year's Day falling on Saturdays, only 33% of firms in a recent survey said they gave workers three or more paid holidays. In 1999, the last time those holidays fell on a Saturday, 50% of organizations reported that they gave their employees three or more paid holidays. The service industry is the worst when it came to giving paid holidays last year. Only 18% gave three or more.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org. Or call 215-563-7110.
When challenged directly by a crowd of America's troops about the Bushites' ongoing damnable failure to provide adequate armor for our soldiers, Pentagon Chief Donnie Rumsfeld was momentarily speechless. As the crowd murmured, Rummy said, "Now settle down, settle down. Hell, I'm an old man. It's early in the morning and I'm gathering my thoughts here." If any of the Bushites need clarity on the scandalous way they treat our soldiers, they need only visit Army Specialist Robert Loria of Middletown, New York. Last February, he was in one of Rumsfeld's unprotected Humvees when it was hit by a roadside bomb in Iraq. Loria's left hand and forearm were blasted off and shrapnel ripped through his body. He spent months in rehab trying to learn how to live without a hand. Finally, just before this Christmas, he was due to be released and return home when he was hit with another bomb. Rumsfeld's Pentagon presented Loria with a bill for $1,700, claiming he had erroneously received family separation pay while in rehab, plus travel expenses connected to his treatment. Also, they billed him for some of the Humvee parts damaged in the bombing that tore off his hand. Loria was devastated, but the Army brass didn't care, demanding payment before they would release him. Hello, the Halliburtons rip off billions from us taxpayers, but the Pentagon is hounding the grunts. It's almost like I'm being abandoned, Loria said. Like, you did your job for us and now you're no use. That's how it feels. Is that clear enough for you, Mr. Rumsfeld? Thanks to press coverage and intervention by some members of Congress, Loria's nightmarish treatment by the Pentagon has finally ended. The Army was forced to clear Loria's hokey debt and send him home. This is Jim Hightower saying, but why should a soldier who's made such an extreme sacrifice be treated so shabbily in the first place? And how many others are getting the same back of the hand?
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, we made it to 2005. Welcome. Happy New Year. I mean, literally, now here it is, the new year, the first day of this broadcasting this program on the new year, the 3rd of January. Could it be the 3rd? Indeed it is. Amazing. Welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, cable radio network, and with archives at whiterosesociety.org and tomhartman.com. You can find all that, and you can drop into our chat room. Go to tomhartman.com if you'd like. Chat room full of folks. Very, very entertaining. Just very quickly, it's 2005. I want to talk about the trends for the year. Have you called your senators yet? I just called one of my senators. I didn't have enough time to call the second. I'll do it after the show. For the second time in 3 weeks. 1-800. Here's the telephone. I call your senator and ask them to join John Conyers in his protest of the Ohio electors. The number 1-800-839-5276. I'll say that again in just a moment so you can write it down. Now, this is the number, toll-free number, gets you right into the main switchboard in Congress. So whoever your senators are, whatever state you're in, ask for one or the other of them. Each state has two senators. And tell your senator to please join John Conyers, if you're so inclined, in contesting, in at least raising for discussion the possibility of vote fraud in Ohio. The telephone number again, 1-800-839-5276. It's a new year, new trends. Gerald Celente has accurately forecast the Iraq war quagmire, the last two recessions, the dot-com meltdown, the 1997 Asian currency crisis, the 1987 world stock market crash, increasing terrorism against America, and in 1993 predicted that at the dawn of the new millennium, a 2000 crusade would be raging. Founder and director of the Trends Research Institute, Celente, if I'm pronouncing that right, is that correct, Gerald?
It's Celente.
Celente, okay.
Correct, yep.
Celente is the author of the national bestseller Trends 2000 and Trend Tracking, and publisher of the internationally circulated Trends Journal, a newsletter published out of Rhinebeck, New York. I used to have an old friend in Rhinebeck who ran the Newsletter Institute there.
Who's that?
Richard. It's been
Howard Hudson.
Or Howard Hudson, yeah, Howard Hudson. Is he still around?
Yeah, he is poor. He's a poor guy. You know, he He's getting on in age, and last year he fell face down in the right on the street, and he's pretty banged up now.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Great fella.
He is. He's really a good man. He was a real mentor of mine in my early days in the advertising business. Anyhow, Howard Hudson, good guy. Okay, so Gerald, you're here with us, and your trends journal, you predict a number of trends for 2005, and right at the top, the very first one in your winter issue, Very Ugly Americans. What are you talking about here?
Well, back in 2001, we did Ugly Americans, and we saw that the world was turning anti-American, but then we saw it as basically a Washington administration issue, abrogating the Kyoto agreements, a number of things, human rights issues. But now the world is becoming very anti-American, in the sense that they're now blaming the people. You know that famous headline from the England's Daily Mirror, how could 59,820,060 people be so dumb?
Right.
And they referring to the election. And taking that into context, it's regarding the Iraq war. The whole world is against this war. And the footage that they see on their TVs is very different than ours. People don't ride around with yellow ribbon insignias affixed to their cars or see their news broadcasters with little American flags on their lapel.
In fact, what's particularly interesting about this is that CNN International shows the dead civilians, screaming people in hospitals, the consequences of American bombings on both sides, presents fairly balanced coverage, balanced in that it is not, you know, gung-ho, rah-rah, American, and non-sanitized, whereas CNN Domestic presents an entirely sanitized view of the war for Americans. I find that one of the most fascinating ironies
well,
is not quite the right
media
word.
It's in the United States, exactly. And then the other one is Israel. It's the same thing there. America has a unflinching support for Israel, and the people around the world see very different news coverage. And they also understand that any time there's a world court finding or a UN resolution condemning Israel, the United States, in the sense of the UN, is likely to veto it. So they see the Americans and the American people highly responsible for the conditions that exist throughout the Middle East and making the world an unsafer place. According to the polls, they're showing that they look at America and Israel, number one and two, as the two most dangerous countries in the world.
Now let me just toss in here, Gerald. We're talking with Gerald Celente, the publisher of the Trends Journal, the Trends Research Institute forecasting worldwide since 1980. That you're not representing yourself as a psychic, and certainly not as a partisan, as a Democrat or as a libertarian or independent or whatever. You are an analyst of trends.
My work over the years, I'm a political atheist. You know, I look at the world for what it is and not the way I want it to be. And while I'm an American, I'm also a citizen of the world. So we just analyze current events, and we look at them as a doctor would diagnose a patient.
Yeah.
Doesn't make him an optimist or a pessimist or good or bad. It's just what is.
Right.
So we're looking at polls, and we're looking at reactions.
So
our Trends Journal is subscribed to by businesses. So we tell them, for instance, look, when you're promoting your product overseas, don't play up the American thing. Go for more universal themes.
Right. In other words, this is just a pragmatic approach to this. Your second story here is doing the Iraq drag, and explain to us what that's about.
Well, again, you know, we're not Monday morning quarterbacks with this, Tom. What happened was 1 month before the Iraq war began, we issued a trend alert, and we said, quote, while victory on the battlefield may be swift considering the massive military power of the U.S., the war against Iraq will eventually be lost. And we go on to say, you know, that the Iraqi generals have promised to launch unrelenting suicide attacks against coalition forces and a vow to fight down to the last man to repel invaders. Thus, a guerrilla war will drag on until they have regained control of their country. So we wrote that a month before the war. But as you mentioned about the coverage being sanitized in the United States, we dare not go on any of the major media and say this because it's not what the people wanted to hear, and we would be branded for saying it. So this war
by we, you mean you?
About things changing.
Gerald, by we, do you mean you?
Excuse me?
By we, do you mean you? If you were to go on major media and say this?
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting. So if you're on, you're saying things here on this program that you couldn't safely say on Meet the Press or Face the Nation or even Crossfire.
Right.
Or
I could say them now, but I could not report this. I stayed out of the media that year. I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to put my business and my 25 years of building this business, on the line for some crazies to look at the information and spin it to their ideological beliefs.
Yeah.
It's not
yeah.
my, you know, I'm not looking to save the world.
Yeah. You're just looking to report on it.
That's
so, okay, your number three trend here, the whole health diet. This is a little out of politics. We'll just briefly touch on that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, what it is that these diet crazes come and go, and current events form future trends. You see with the Celebrex, Vioxx, Aleve, people are getting to realize that there's no quick fix. And diet, the slow carb, by the way, it's cut in half by 50% now, the people that were doing it a year ago, people are going to realize that weight loss is a byproduct of living healthy, spiritually, emotionally, and physically. And we're going to see more direction in that way.
So it'll be more of a shift toward a holistic perspective on weight loss rather than a mechanistic, if you simply modify fat or if you simply modify carbs, you know, the old idea of kind of tweaking the carburetor, there's one little screw that's going to change everything. Instead, there's this view, it's going to become a more holistic perspective.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Even the word diet, for instance, the soft drink companies are pulling it out of their advertising. They're calling their products C2, Edge, that kind of thing, zero,
right,
rather than diet.
Well, as the beer companies did originally. They originally developed diet beers, and when they tried to market them, they discovered very quickly nobody wanted, no He-Man wanted to be drinking a diet beer, so they all became light beers. But anyhow, the next one you have here is the 5-0 economy for 05. What's this
well,
about?
That's a formula that we made up at the Trends Research Institute. And briefly, what they are open markets, overcapacity, overproduction, online, and which one am I leaving
out? Overpopulation.
Overpopulation, thank you.
Right.
So what we have is, let's start with overpopulation. You start from zero and go to 1920. We've added 2 billion people on the planet. From 1920 to now, we've added another 4 billion. So when people say they're population experts, they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And this is, by the way, this 5-0 formula, this tells you why that Americans can expect in the future lower wages, working longer and harder, less disposable income, less benefits, less pensions.
Now, wouldn't you say that's as long as we continue to participate on a relatively level playing field with so-called open markets? I mean, if we were to go back to the pre-Reagan times when we had substantial tariff barriers to free trade, when we were doing what China is doing today, we were saying you can only import a product into this country if you pay a tax on that product that balances the cost of producing it domestically versus producing it offshore, so that manufacturers would come back into the United States. That then things could be very, very different. But as long as we maintain our membership in WTO and NAFTA and all this, we're going to continue to see these things.
Well, we would call it pre-Clinton, actually. I mean, Clinton's the
well,
one
Clinton was the big one, but I mean, it really
Clinton's
began with
the one
Reagan.
That brought NAFTA to
right
to,
NAFTA and GATT, right?
And neither Bush Senior nor Reagan could pull that one off.
No, but they were pushing for it, and they made many, many, many changes in our trade
many
policies.
Changes,
hundreds
but
of
we
them.
We pitted
on this.
Clinton primarily.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go along
but
with
anyway,
you on that.
But anyway, going back
sure.
to the open markets, that's the second O. And with overpopulation, you have an infinite supply of both skilled and unskilled labor.
Yeah.
Overcapacity, when you go back to the late 1990s, people were expecting double-digit growth, and they ramped up for it, and now we have overproduction.
Right.
You go into a store after Christmas. In the old days, in a department store, the shelves would be bare. Now products falling on the floor.
Gerald, we're down to 20 seconds here. The bottom line of all of this, Great Depression
lower income,
or just...
lower standard of living.
Yeah. It's tighter times for America.
Yes.
Fascinating. And how can people find out more about your website or your...
They could go to trendsresearch.com and they could see the rest of the top 10 trends at trendsresearch.com.
Trendsresearch.com. Gerald say it for me. Salente?
Salente.
Thank you, Gerald Salente. Trends Research, Trends Tracker, Trends 2000. Thanks so much for being with us. 20 minutes
Thank
past
you.
The hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at democraticmatch.com.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oric, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oric XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oric XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th, 2004.
Thank you for calling about DirecTV. My name is Lynn. How can I help you?
Thank you, sir. Thank goodness you're there. You've got to help me. My cable company is raising their rates again. I don't know what I'm going to do.
It's okay, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm glad you called.
They're taking away our favorite channels and charging more. It's just wrong.
Ma'am, I get that all the time. Let me help you right away. Would you like to get over 125 channels of your favorite programming for only $39.99?
Will I still be able to get my local channels?
Absolutely. And because you called American Satellite right now, you can get up to a 4-room DirecTV system for free and free professional installation for all new customers with an annual programming commitment.
Oh, thank you. My husband, Nick, is going to be so happy.
Call American Satellite at 1-800-505-1542. That's 800-505-1542. Call now and ask how you can get total choice for only $29.99 a month for the first 6 months. A $60 value. 800-505-1542. At $4.99 a month per second and each additional receiver. Offer ends July 17, 2004. Call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We got a president so bad, gotta be the worst we ever had. Got the job 'cause of his dad, now we're all in danger.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website, Turn Your Back on Bush.org makes the point, the election is over, the fight is not. Elections are only one part of democracy. We need to think strategically about direct action, learn from a rich history of nonviolent activism, and develop new tactics to take on this administration. Let's start from the start, they say, Inauguration Day. That's January 20th. They're calling for a new kind of action. The Bush administration, they say, has been successful at keeping protesters away from major events in the last few years by closing off areas around events and using questionable legal strategies to outlaw public dissent. Well, here's the bottom line, rather than reading their shtick. They're asking people to show up, and when Bush goes by, turn your back on him. Look like a good Republican, so they will let you in. Isn't this bizarre? I mean, this is like the times of Joseph Stalin. This is like Khrushchev. You can't get in if you have a carry button on. You can't get in if you don't sign a loyalty oath to the Republicans. You can't get in if you don't pay a lot of money. $250,000, $100,000, hundreds of... What is wrong with this picture? 1-866-889-8894. Rick in Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Yes, good day to you, Tom. I was looking at CNN headline news, and I saw a headline that Bill Frist, quote from him, and I actually agree with this. He was saying we can afford to do this, meaning I guess the United States can afford to help the victims of the tsunami, the terrible disaster in that part of the world.
Right.
But I think it's interesting that almost all politicians will talk a good game as far as balancing the budget. But, you know, somehow the real world intrudes. Now, for many conservatives, of course, they don't think there's any price too high to pay for the war on terror, so-called. And people like you and I may disagree. And then we have things like the tsunami problem, which I guess all of us could agree that in the short term, at least, we have to not worry about how much it costs, but just help the victims. But there's so many other areas where that might be the case, you know, to fix schools, fix roads, help homeless people. Where does it all end, you know? And I guess my point is everybody wants to talk a fiscal conservatism, except if it's an issue that they agree with, and then the sky's the limit. Don't you agree?
Yeah. In fact, we got a news release today from the Ayn Rand folks, and we may have one of them on later in the week to talk about this, suggesting that we have no business sending money to Indonesia or Malaysia or any of those other countries that were hit by the tsunami. They're not us. So why are we spending foreign aid?
They're consistent, aren't they?
They actually are, and I have to say I respect them for that, for their consistency. I think they're nuts, but I respect their consistency. Or I don't think they're nuts. I strongly disagree with their worldview.
They're very intelligent. They're just very cold.
Well, that's part of the problem, I think, and that is that there is this worldview that says, this is ours, this is mine, to hell with everybody else. And the problem with that is that the logical extension of that is it takes you back to the world that Charles Dickens lived in. And so brilliantly chronicled in books like The Christmas Carol and so on. And this is not, we have decided in the United States, largely since the 1930s, although I would say we also decided back at the founding of this country, this is not the kind of world or nation in which we want to live. We want to live in a nation that respects interdependence.
I think it's actually worse than that, though, Tom, because actually, you know, I'm an animal lover, but like when I feed my cat, you know, every cat wants to go on the other one's dish. When I feed the birds in the backyard, they all chase each other away because they want the food for themselves. You know, if the Ayn Rand people had their way, we would be no better than the animals, because animals, as a rule, and there probably are exceptions to this, are very selfish creatures. They will worry about their young, if they're mothers, for instance, but they're pretty much out, you know, dog-eat-dog, as the term goes. And if we want to degenerate to that level, the Ayn Rand people, as intelligent as they are, would actually reduce us to the level of animals.
Well, it would actually be far below that level, because if you have more than one cat, you know that there is a pecking order. But once the pecking order is established, they make sure everybody gets fed. And the same with the birds. I mean, we haven't seen a sudden, you know, die-off of birds because one species has...
You're right. It would be worse.
It would be far worse, because there is homeostasis in nature, and these guys don't see it in the United States. Coming up right after... Thanks for the call, Rick. Good to hear from you. Coming up right after the break, we're going to talk with one of the members of the Electoral College, that mysterious body, who is calling on Congress to take seriously John Conyers' question, shall we say. 29 minutes past the hour.
Mom, I can't believe you asked Rick all those questions. Where do you live, and who are your parents? It's so embarrassing.
Getting to know your kid's friends isn't easy, but if you don't, he's more likely to do drugs.
Geez, do you have to know everything?
Actually, Sean, I do.
Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
As the AARP gears up to spend more than $5 million to oppose plans by the Bush administration to begin privatizing Social Security, Karl Rove is stepping up to shape the president's public relations campaign. According to the Washington Post, Rove, with the help of White House official Charles P. Blauhaus, planned to raise anywhere from $50 million to $100 million to convince the American people that the president's Social Security initiative needs to be enacted. The new plan would allow younger workers to invest part of their Social Security contribution into the stock market. The NAACP, AFL-CIO, and National Organization of Women have all said they oppose plans to privatize Social Security and are coordinating with Democratic leaders in Congress. On the other side of the aisle, conservative groups like Club for Growth and Progress for America are raising funds alongside corporate trade associations like the National Association of Manufacturers. Many corporations that support privatization have already begun sending money to a group called the Alliance for Worker Retirement Security. Bush is expected to go public with his plans later this month. The coming Social Security fight will be one of the biggest public policy battles in years.
The Republican-dominated National Labor Relations Board has issued a string of rulings tilting in favor of employers over workers. The decisions have made it more difficult for temporary workers to organize unions and have made it easier for employers to use lockouts against workers, among other things. These decisions have been party-line votes, with Republicans opposing the positions taken by workers. Cornell professor James Gross, an author of several books about the NLRB, says these decisions are fundamentally inconsistent with the purpose of the NLRB, which is to encourage collective bargaining.
The union representing police officers in Orlando, Florida, filed a lawsuit against that city's mayor last week, demanding records of his travel expenses and cell phone usage. The officers, represented by the Fraternal Order of Police, are currently involved in bitter contract negotiations with Mayor Buddy Dyer and are demanding his public records to seek out any wrongdoing. The police union has also taken the fight to the sky, flying a banner behind a plane during the Citrus Bowl parade that said, "Mayor Dyer, show police your public record. It's the law." According to the mayor's office, the records have been available for review for months, but no one from the union had asked if they were done. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Employers gave workers less paid holidays in 2004 than in recent years. With both Christmas and New Year's Day falling on Saturdays, only 33% of firms in a recent survey said they gave workers three or more paid holidays. In 1999, the last time those holidays fell on a Saturday, 50% of organizations reported that they gave their employees three or more paid holidays. The service industry is the worst when it came to giving paid holidays last year. Only 18% gave three or more.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's the billionaires for Bush.
We're electing Georgie Bushy, cause our lives are soft and cushy. We're electing Georgie Bushy. Wait your turn now, don't be Bushy.
There you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 26 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jeff Taylor is an attorney from Rutland, Vermont, and an elector for John Kerry. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
Jeff, explain to our listeners what an elector is.
Well, there are 538 electors who are appointed to the Electoral College by vote in the general election. There are 50 general elections in the 50 states. The electors who are part of the 120 million people who voted this year are 538 in number. Their job, among other things, is to convene on a day in December to vote for both president and vice president.
Now,
those are the votes that really count.
Right. Now, the Article 2 of Section 2 of the Constitution, as I recall, specifies that there will be an electoral college. And then the 12th Amendment, which was passed in 1804 after the mess of the election of 1800, kind of modified that and cleaned it up a little bit. But the bottom line is that originally the Electoral College was based on the old Saxon notion that was articulated by Paul de Ripon de Thurras in his book The History of England, as well Ecclesiastical as Civic, which was published in 1728, and that all the founders had. In fact, Jefferson, one of the first four books that he gave to the Library of Congress was this book. And in it, Thurras writes, now, in order to preserve a perfect union, here, language written 10 years before Jefferson was born that later made its way into the Constitution. Now, in order to preserve a perfect union, it was necessary some way communication and intercourse between them, the people in remote locations, and their government should be established. This was done by the means of the Wittenagemot, or Assembly of Wise Men, who were the representatives of the whole nation. And he talks about how this is how England did it from the time the Romans left around 400 with the fall of the Roman Empire until the Normans, the French, invaded in 1066 and took over England at the Battle of Hastings. And during that 600-year period, essentially England was tribal, or the British Isles were tribal, and the tribal groups would elect electors who would go to these annual councils, this annual assembly of wise men, or the Wittenagemot. And this was the thing that the founders modeled the Electoral College on. And the original idea was that the states would nominate the wisest men among their people and send them however they chose to do it, that a state could... the governor of a state could do it by however they chose to write their constitutions. A governor of a state could appoint their electors, the representatives, the members of Congress and the House could be the electors, however they want, or they could hold elections to do this. And now, by tradition, we have, in all 50 states, we actually vote for our electors. We think we're voting for president, but we're actually voting for our electors. Do you know, by the way, when that transition happened from states doing it in various ways to states 100% of it being done by direct election? Was that as early as 1804, or was there some middle point?
Well, let me put it this way. The Constitution provides that the states shall appoint electors either by election or other means. And the other means includes appointment by the state legislatures themselves. And
right.
That provision, that method of direct appointment by the legislatures, not by the voters, ended, continued as late as the 1930s.
And in fact, Florida threatened it in 2000.
That's correct.
Tom Feeney, the Speaker of the House of Representatives in Florida, said, if we do a recount, and if this recount shows that Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush in the state of Florida, we will, the House of Representatives of the state of Florida, nonetheless send a slate of electors to Washington, D.C., voting for George W. Bush.
Yes, and that would be legal under the Constitution.
Right.
The last state that did that as a regular means of selecting electors was South Carolina, which, to my recollection, abolished that in 1932.
That's interesting.
So now all states elect electors by direct election. I should add, however, one little difference here. The founders were not by any means unanimous about an electoral college. There was quite a debate. A fair number wanted direct election.
Well, and before that, actually, there was a larger debate about whether or not there should even be a president.
Correct.
I mean, this was the original debate. Everybody was afraid that if, on the one hand, you had the Jeffersonians, the who became the Democratic Republicans, who were arguing that there should not be a position of president, and then you had the Federalists who and the leftover kind of pseudo Tories who felt that we had to have a head of state, a figurehead, if nothing else, who could you know, oversee state functions and things. And then there were those like Hamilton and Adams who felt that that figurehead should also be the head of government, like a prime minister. And that's what we ended up with.
Right. In the early debates among the founders for an electoral college, which was a compromise, I should add, at very, very late in the framing of the Constitution, was that the electors would, as you indicated earlier, would constitute wise men. I mean, they were all men, no women allowed.
Right.
No surprise.
Well, actually, the Constitution doesn't require it to be men. I mean, it was up until the 1830s that in many states women were voting, blacks were voting. It was because the Constitution gave the right to states to decide who could vote.
Exactly.
Pardon my picking a small point, but it's one that I think the founders get a bad rap on this a lot of the time because they didn't write into the Constitution. The first time the word male appears in the Constitution is the 14th Amendment, which wasn't ratified until after the Civil War.
Right. The colony of New Jersey, for example, provided before our independence, gave women some limited rights to vote in local elections, even before the Constitution.
Yeah.
But I should add that the earlier concept of the Electoral College was that it would be an assembly that would nominate perhaps many as five individuals, and then the election would actually take place in the Congress. Not among
right.
the Electoral College, and that broke down, of course, early on when the Electoral College voted for Jefferson and Adams, you know, from opposite political standpoints, and that resulted in a deadlock, which occasioned the amendment about which you spoke,
right.
providing the elector shall vote separately for president and vice president.
Right, in 1804. So
correct. You know your history.
Yeah. I do. This is a fascinating discussion, and however, let's cut to the chase here with what's really the main reason I wanted to have you on the program. I love giving people background. I think it's so important. We live in such a historical vacuum in the United States. We don't teach civics and history in our elementary schools the way that we did just 40 years ago in the United States any longer.
Sure.
And it's so important that people understand these things. And yet the reason that I called you and asked you to be on the program, that the main thing that really got my attention was that you and the other three electors from the state of Vermont, along with electors from, as I recall, four other states, or is it three other states?
I think four other states.
Four other states, okay, including Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, North Carolina, I believe.
Yeah. And in Massachusetts, they actually did a big ceremony where they came out with top hats and dressed like billionaires kind of thing. To make this declaration, but you and your two peers, the three electors from the state of Vermont, each state having a number of electors equal to its congressional delegation, so we have two senators and one congressman. You and your two peers have written and signed a resolution that you have submitted to whom?
Well, it's I'll give you a little background about this as well. The three electors, I being one of them. From Clarendon, the other electors are from Brookfield, and the other elector from Woodstock. Three of us met briefly before the actual vote on December 13th, talked about how we were troubled by news of significant irregularities, problems in Ohio, in Florida, New Mexico, many other states, and that we as electors had a responsibility to say something about these troubling developments, particularly in view of the strong, strong likelihood that if these violations are widespread, that they violate the equal protection rights of voters. And three of us talked about this, agreed unanimously in principle on the things we wanted to say. We then voted. I was given the task of preparing a resolution, which I did right after the vote. And we had subsequently signed the resolution and have called upon our U.S. senators and one representative to give careful consideration in the first instance to the ongoing investigation about irregularities in Ohio and elsewhere. And to if the evidence that's developed shows these widespread violations, and if they are significant, that they consider raising objections on January 6th to the counting of electoral votes from Ohio and certain other states on the grounds that the electors from those states are
illegitimate,
invalid.
Yeah, are illegitimate.
Yeah. The certifications are invalid because of these constitutional violations, that they infect the integrity of the voting in those states. In addition to that, we also asked for some systemic reforms, such as uniform rules for the issuance and tabulation of provisional absentee ballots, for sufficient funding of the Help America Vote Act, for sponsoring other kinds of legislation that would mandate paper records and trails and backups for voting machines, and in general to support the inquiries made by the General Accounting Office right now into problems, electoral problems, and for our representatives, our senators, to seek solutions so that we don't repeat this every 4 years.
Yeah, or every 2 years.
Not good for democracy.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jeff Taylor. He's an attorney from Rutland, Vermont, and a Cary elector. That is a. Does that make you a member of the Electoral College this year? Is that a title? Okay.
I'm from Clarendon, Vermont.
Clarendon. I'm sorry.
That's right.
I need to write that down lest I get it wrong here. Clarendon. And
we're very proud of our town.
There you go. And although it doesn't really matter, because it matters to you where you live, of course. But an elector can be from anywhere in the state, right? Electors
correct.
Have nothing to do with. They're not chosen from geographically. They're chosen
correct.
Generally by the parties. I mean, you and your two peers were chosen by the Vermont Democratic Party to be the electors.
Yep.
Is that not
we
correct?
Were nominated by the party at the platform convention, which was held in September.
Now, to the best of your knowledge, have members of the Electoral College, such as yourself, ever in the history of the United States protested the actions of other electors, the legitimacy of other electors, or even questioned the Electoral College itself in such a public way as you are doing now?
Well, I would say that's a two-part question. I'm unaware of electors challenging other electors, number one. Number two, I will say there have been a number of instances of electors criticizing the Electoral College. I did this 4 years ago, for example, when I was a member then, and have strongly, strongly supported the abolition of the Electoral College and replacement by direct election. And I will say that my other two electors this year favor that as well.
Yeah.
So in answer to your question, no and yes.
No, yes. Okay. So, but in other words, in a way, what you have done here, what you and the electors from four other states have done, is historic. I mean, this is something that hasn't been done since 1804, when the Electoral College was amended and decided to be kept. Presumably, before then, there was some debate, right, which brought about the 12th Amendment.
It is a first.
This is absolutely remarkable. In fact, I got to say, I love catching people doing things right. So, good on you, Jeff Taylor. We caught you doing something right.
Hey, thank you.
There you go. That's our theme music for caught you doing that. I'm just so impressed. Just one last question here. We only have about a minute and a half left.
Yes,
when I voted for John Kerry here. I was voting
voted for John Kerry's electors.
I know. I was voting actually for an elector. How do I know which of the three electors in Vermont I was voting for? And are there any rule? Are those rules consistent from state to state, or does each state figure out how to do it?
Well, it's all governed by state law from state to state.
Okay.
In Vermont, the electors are nominated. Their names are not on the ballot, but by state law, you vote for all three of us.
Oh, I see.
And
so
some states. The electors' names are still on the ballot.
Right, and you're just voting for one elector, or you're voting for the slate of electors?
You vote for the slate.
For the slate. So electors are never broken up geographically. So I voted for you this time. I didn't vote for John Kerry. I voted for Jeff Taylor, right?
I It was the easiest campaign I ever ran.
And you won. That's remarkable.
Yes, we won. Yeah,
there you go. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this thing plays out. Jeff Taylor, attorney from Clarendon, Vermont, and a member of the Electoral College, one of the 538 members of the Electoral College, this time protesting or pointing out, asking the other electors and asking our members of Congress to question the possible legitimacy and problems of this election. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, you're very welcome.
I appreciate it. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour. My name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly, so I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique. And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
Female killer whales spend decades as grandmothers, and biologists wonder why. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Female killer whales tend to outlive their male counterparts by at least 30 years. The males usually die after they've passed their peak reproductive age, but female whales can live up to 50 years after they've stopped having calves. This dramatic gap in life expectancy has scientists wondering if grandmothers have a special function in social groups of killer whales. Linda Jones is a marine mammal expert with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Seattle. Jones says male killer whales mature around the age of 15 and they die in their 20s. But the females live much longer, and they live long after their prime reproductive years have come to an end.
Females mature at about 13 to 15 years. At about 40 years, they no longer reproduce. But they're females that are over 90 years old, so they can live a very long time. in this post-reproductive phase. Why would a society have these post-reproductive females? What do they contribute to the population?
One possible explanation is that these grandmothers help raise the young. Jones says post-reproductive females in other species fill that role, but this has not been studied with killer whales. People don't know for sure why the grandmother whales stick around for so long, but Jones says it's important to figure that out. Some populations of killer whales are declining. She says the old females might provide clues about how pods of killer whales function and survive. That information might help people do a better job of protecting these marine mammals. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. The central issue regarding the legitimacy of George W. Bush's presidency will be the unsealing and reading of the electoral vote in the Senate on January 6th, which will be Thursday of this week. The Republicans control the schedule of what happens in the House and the Senate by virtue of committee chairmanships, by virtue of the fact that they control the majority of both bodies. And so the Republicans get to decide what show is going to be held on what particular day. And I find it particularly interesting that on January 6th, on Thursday, if enough people contact their senators and one senator is found who will stand with John Conyers and other members of Congress to suggest that the many so-called irregularities in Ohio, in Florida, and in New Mexico actually may constitute vote fraud and should be investigated, and therefore, then the House and Senate split up for 2 hours, go into separate session and debate, an open debate, whether or not the Ohio vote was legitimate, which would propel this into the national media, this debate that's been happening basically on the Internet and on Keith Olbermann's countdown show. He's the only national media who's covered this. God bless him. If this happens, it will happen on Thursday. Or even if it doesn't happen, it won't happen on Thursday. In either case, that would be a news story. And so I find it fascinating that the Republicans have scheduled for Thursday Senate hearings on Alberto Gonzalez's nomination, in which several Democrats are suggesting that actual photos of torture and abuse at Abu Ghraib should be shown. These hearings, the Republicans know, will be huge news getters. In a way, it's kind of like sacrificing Alberto Gonzalez to avoid embarrassing George W. Bush, because they know Gonzalez is going to get nominated and appointed anyway. You know, he's going to make some, you know, apologies, or he's going to straighten things out. He's going to say, well, you know, we've cleaned that up. In fact, the White House just came out with a new memo on torture, backtracking from Gonzalez's former positions. So he's going to get through. But they're going to let him get a little embarrassed, and it's going to be a big news thing on Thursday. So big, I suspect the Republicans have scheduled this so big that it will eclipse any discussion of the legitimacy of the electoral vote in Ohio. You heard it here first. Let's wait and see. We'll find out. Matt Drudge ranting about it today on the Drudge Report. More coming. More coming. No doubt about it. It's the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the Progressive News magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way: to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
As the AARP gears up to spend more than $5 million to oppose plans by the Bush administration to begin privatizing Social Security, Karl Rove is stepping up to shape the president's public relations campaign. According to the Washington Post, Rove, with the help of White House official Charles P. Blauhaus, planned to raise anywhere from $50 million to $100 million to convince the American people that the president's Social Security initiative needs to be enacted. The new plan would allow younger workers to invest part of their Social Security contribution into the stock market. Then AACP, AFL-CIO, and National Organization of Women have all said they oppose plans to privatize Social Security and are coordinating with Democratic leaders in Congress. On the other side of the aisle, conservative groups like Club for Growth and Progress for America are raising funds alongside corporate trade associations like the National Association of Manufacturers. Many corporations that support privatization have already begun sending money to a group called the Alliance for Worker Retirement Security. Bush is expected to go public with his plans later this month. The coming Social Security fight will be one of the biggest public policy battles in years.
The Republican-dominated National Labor Relations Board has issued a string of rulings tilting in favor of employers over workers. The decisions have made it more difficult for temporary workers to organize unions and have made it easier for employers to use lockouts against workers, among other things. These decisions have been party-line votes, with Republicans opposing the positions taken by workers. Cornell professor James Gross, an author of several books about the NLRB, says these decisions are fundamentally inconsistent with the purpose of the NLRB, which is to encourage collective bargaining.
The union representing police officers in Orlando, Florida, filed a lawsuit against that city's mayor last week, demanding records of his travel expenses and cell phone usage. The officers, represented by the Fraternal Order of Police, are currently involved in bitter contract negotiations with Mayor Buddy Dyer and are demanding his public records to seek out any wrongdoing. The police union has also taken the fight to the sky, flying a banner behind a plane during the Citrus Bowl parade that said, "Mayor Dyer, show police your public record. It's the law." According to the mayor's office, the records have been available for review for months, but no one from the union had asked if they were done. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Employers gave workers less paid holidays in 2004 than in recent years. With both Christmas and New Year's Day falling on Saturdays, only 33% of firms in a recent survey said they gave workers three or more paid holidays. In 1999, the last time those holidays fell on a Saturday, 50% of organizations reported that they gave their employees three or more paid holidays. The service industry is the worst when it came to giving paid holidays last year. Only 18% gave three or more.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org. Or call 215-563-7110.
Home Depot is coming to my town, riding in on tracks of gold, courtesy of us taxpayers. This is not merely another of Home Depot's big box stores, mind you, but by gollies, a high-tech data center. To get the giant corporation to choose Austin, state and local officials approached it in the professional manner that corporations now expect. by frantically hurling huge sackfuls of taxpayers' money at them, desperately hoping that our sacks are fuller than those being hurled by other cities. In this case, our sacks contain more than $30 million, and, lucky us, Home Depot grabbed them. Our public officials are now peacocking around over this deal, bragging that they're delivering 500 jobs to we the people, averaging $58,000 a year in pay. Actually, though, you wouldn't get one paying $58,000. That average includes the salary, bonuses, and such of those up in the new data center's executive suite. Averages, you see, are tricksters. If you are paid $20,000, for example, and the top dog gets $200,000, you're averaging $110,000 each. Home Depot's package includes nearly $6 million in a special tax break from the Austin School District. Yes, that means $6 million that should go to the education of school kids will not, for district officials have given this corporation an exemption from paying its school taxes. Yet the Austin School Board is trying to pull a fast one on us by asserting that the state reimburses school districts for any revenue they lose when they dole out tax breaks to corporations. As one board member put it, there is no cost to the Austin taxpayer. Earth to school board. The Austin taxpayer is also a state taxpayer. The tax giveaway to Home Depot still comes from our pockets, and it's still $6 million that could have been added to education, but now won't be. This is Jim Hightower saying, Home Depot is super rich. Why shouldn't it pay its taxes like our homegrown businesses do?
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Sometime in the next 10, 15, 20 years. Depends on whose numbers you're using, I suppose. But there's a broad consensus. In the next 15 years, more or less, we're going to the Social Security Trust Fund is going to have to actually start spending some of the money that it has invested from the surplus it has accumulated over the last few decades, which means that the government is going to have to start paying itself back, which means that George W. may have to raise taxes or cut other programs. And that's something that I suspect a lot of people are real unhappy about. Among them is Craig Smith. Craig is an economist, a financial expert, author, lecturer, president of Swiss America Trading Corporation, one of America's finer dealers in gold coins and things like this, and which, in my opinion, is an excellent investment. And Craig, you're of the opinion, first of all, you represent yourself as an economist. How did you come by that?
Oh, Tom, gosh, years of study, following economic and geopolitical trends over the last 23 years. I think I was dubbed with the title economist by my peers, not so much myself. By training, I'm mainly, believe it or not, a broadcaster. I did my own talk show for a number of years and then basically dove in both feet in studying money systems throughout the country, everything from the United States of America all the way down to the recent Chilean model.
Well, the reason I ask, Craig, is because in your article or your press release or whatever here that we mm-hmm. have about you. You say that FDR was a socialist, and I did study economics, and my understanding of socialism, I actually read Das Kapital, not as a Marxist. I am a free market capitalist. In Das Kapital, Marx lays out the definition of socialism as the sure. state controlling the means of production and supply. And to the best of my knowledge, FDR never advocated anything like that. The closest he got to that was the WPA, which was intended very clearly to be a financial stimulus and a short-term program. And, in fact, it did go away during his presidency. I mean, how could you call him a socialist?
Well, I think that if you look at just the way that he put together the whole Social Security package, which was basically intended, if you go by what FDR said, was designed to take care of the one-third of the ill-clad, ill-housed, and ill-fed Americans after the Great Depression, you know, you may be right in saying he wasn't a socialist, but when you take what his intention was and then what he allowed it to morph into, I can't imagine that we can't think to some extent that he believed this cradle-to-grave mentality that a government was supposed to be there to take care of you regardless of what you did right or wrong in your life. And evidence of that is clear in the Social Security plan, where it was referred to as the Federal Insurance Contribution Act. You and I both know, Tom, that it's not a contribution that we make, it's a tax.
So we have then you're suggesting that other socialist programs, for example, roads, public roads, we should mm-hmm. privatize them?
Well, I don't think roads are a socialist problem or a socialist event as much as they are a free market event if the roads were bid out independently to private corporations for the guy who's going to do it the cheapest with the best work.
They're paid for with my tax dollars.
Well, but see, original government in the way that our founding fathers had intended it, we were never supposed to run off income tax to begin with.
Okay, yeah, which is a whole other discussion, and we can get into the history of that if you want. I mean, you know, we did start out with taxes, though. They were tariffs, and I think we should be going back to them. But that's, you know,
excise taxes, I think, were a bright idea. I don't think that federal income tax really helped us, and I'm not advocating that we abolish income taxes. We got to pay for.
Yeah, okay. So you don't want to get rid of the socialist roads. What about the socialist police and fire departments? There are no private corporations involved in those. Should we get rid of those? Should we go back to the free market solution we used to have, where if your house was on fire and you had the wrong medallion, the fire department would just drive on by because that private fire department wasn't the one that you were paying?
Well, we have a perfect example of that here in Arizona, where we have what's called Rural Metro, which is a private fire department, if you will, which does a far better job at far less cost to the city. And now you're starting to see many of our suburbs in Phoenix farm that work out to private corporations because they can do it better.
So you do think that we should do away with socialist fire departments?
Well, I'm not sure that I would consider them socialist fire departments, Tom. I mean, you're suggesting that I think that fire departments are socialist in their nature because you think that I believe that FDR was strictly a socialist.
No, I'm saying they're socialist in their nature because it's we protecting us.
That was my point in my writings, as I said, that I believe that he had the nature of a socialist. I don't think I specifically refer to him as a socialist. However, look, there's an argument that Franklin Roosevelt ever got us out of the Depression, Tom. I mean, he recalled gold at $20.67 an ounce, revalued it at $35 an ounce, thus giving him the ability to print 75% more currency than we had at the time, which then was put into the system to pull us out of the Great Depression. So some could suggest we've never even come out of the Depression because the government pulled us out of the Depression versus the free market pulling us out of the Depression.
Well, the flip side of that argument is that the government is more efficient at pulling nations out of the Depression than a free market is.
Well,
I mean, isn't that what you just
really
said?
Do you really believe that? I think that the market does a far better job than government. I think, if anything, government has a tendency to repress markets and hold markets back. Now, if you're suggesting that we need protection from monopolies and people that would or corporations that would exploit people, then I would probably agree with you on that.
But that's not a free market.
Pardon me?
But then you don't have a free market.
Well, sure, you have a free market.
You have a regulated market.
Well, no, there's a difference between regulating a market and putting certain standards in place. I mean, are you going to say that it's okay for somebody who's burning coal to fire their plant up, that if they have to occasionally throw the guy in who shovels the coal into the furnace and he dies, that that's okay? And if you stop that, that's socialism?
No, that's murder. That's a whole different thing. But there are folks who suggest that if you're firing up a coal power plant and selling the electricity and right. downwind, people are dying from the soot, that's tough. That's the free market.
Well,
they don't have to buy that electricity if they don't want it.
You know, I suppose we could go to the extremes of that.
Well, that's not the extremes. That's the reality right now. I mean, here in Vermont, one out of three lakes you can't eat fish out of because of mercury from power plants in Ohio. Now in the state of Wyoming, they don't have a problem with the power plants in Ohio because the winds blow from the west to the east here.
Well, I'm not versed enough about your ecological situations in Vermont to address them. I can tell you that I believe Social Security and the way that it was designed and the way that it has evolved over the years is clearly a socialist program. It's a program that has this belief that the government owes you something from cradle to grave, and I'm not sure that that's a smart way to look at things. I mean, let's be honest about Social Security for a minute, Tom. Does somebody like Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or even Craig Smith need Social Security in their retirement?
Well, that discussion of whether or not means testing should be part of Social Security is, I think, a legitimate part of the debate. But that's not the core of Social Security. The core of the Social Security is more the question of, you can call it socialism if you want, and I assume that when you say that, you intend to alienate people. You want people to think that it's a bad thing. But whether or not it's socialism, and I'll even give you for a moment. Let's say it
well,
is.
Well, I'm not suggesting it's socialism. I'm suggesting it has a socialist.
Right, but let's set aside the rhetoric here and just cut right to the chase. If we the people in a democratic republic, in a constitutionally limited democratic republic, if we the people agree that we collectively want to provide ourselves with some form of protection, mm-hmm. realizing that the use of the force of government involves coercion, what's right. wrong with that?
Well, I suppose there's nothing wrong with it.
That's what we have done. The majority of we, the people, for 70 years now have supported Social Security.
No, you haven't. You've been forced to pay it.
I could have voted people out of office who wanted to. I could have voted into office people who wanted to abolish Social Security at any time. We the people have supported Social Security all these years by virtue of our franchise, of our vote.
Oh, okay. Well, I suppose we
the people through our elected people, through our elected officials, put Social Security in. We have not removed it. We have removed a lot of things that we haven't liked.
I haven't seen citizen
referendums. There are a lot of states where you can do citizen referendums. I haven't seen,
It
seems to me like it's a popular program.
Well, first off, I wasn't here when Social Security was started, so I guess you and I are victims of some bad legislation that was passed in 1934 and enacted in 1935. I can tell you this, that Social Security, which was referred to, as I said, as the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, was not a legal, that's a terrible word to use. Let me rephrase this. It was a political promise. You have no legal claim to Social Security. You've been paying that money in every year. And if you were to stand in front of a judge and say, Your Honor, I'm owed this money, and he said, well, let me see your legal claim to it, there isn't one that exists, Tom.
No, but it's a political promise. And the reality is that if Social Security ever defaulted or stopped paying, heads would roll and things
would
change.
Do you think so?
Well, yeah, I do. I do. Unless you guys are successful. You know, Steve Moore has raised millions of dollars. Now there's this talk about raising over $100 million to do a massive public relations campaign to convince Americans that we need to replace Social Security with a privatized system.
And are you suggesting that Social Security is okay?
Yeah, I'm in favor of Social Security. I'm a big fan of Social Security as an insurance program. And we have other mandated insurance programs. And for example, auto insurance. I'm guessing, Craig, in your state, you can't drive a car without car insurance.
Well, then again, it's a matter of personal choice. By law, you can't, but there are plenty of people that do it.
Well, there you go. But by law, you must do it. Now, here's the conundrum. Because that law is forcing you to buy insurance, you're having to buy that insurance from private for-profit corporations. And those corporations are providing auto insurance typically operates on a margin of anywhere from 12 to 26%. So 12 to 26% of all the dollars that you pay in for auto insurance don't go to pay out to claims benefits or to fix cars. They go to pay multi-million dollar salaries to the CEOs of the insurance companies. They go to pay dividends to the stockholders. And that's the exact same thing that you're suggesting we should do with Social Security. Right now it's got overhead of 1%, and you want to give it to folks like you in the financial services industry so you can make a whole lot more money, right?
Well, using your theory, I don't have to buy car insurance, do I? I guess I can choose to go without it and break the law because nobody forces me to buy car insurance. So I guess I could just not buy it.
Actually, no, that's not true because the law requires you to, just like the law requires you to pay Social Security insurance.
Yeah, but in your world, I don't have to do that.
I'm suggesting you do have to do it. I'm saying, you know, we have mandated. We already have privatized some insurance functions. We've privatized auto insurance. And you're suggesting we should privatize Social Security insurance. And I'm saying if you do, you're going to have the same kind of expenses. Craig, let me give you a chance to answer that in full. I know you feel like I'm chopping you off, but I want to make
that's fine. I enjoyed this.
It's a good conversation. We got to take a break here, though. We got hard breaks on this show. Let's take a break. If anybody wants to call, our number 1-866-889-8894. We're talking to Craig Smith. He's an author, an economist, a lecturer, president of Swiss America Trading Company. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour, my name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oric, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oric XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oric XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartman program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartman.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver.
Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palisex books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
So, hey, there's a new American way. No one serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. You watch the Sunshine State, how the scales got tipped to seal Al's fate. Jeb Bush winked, I told you so.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes, 25 minutes before the hour, 20 after the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org and in cable systems in 29 states on Cable Radio Network. Welcome back. We're talking with Craig Smith, president of the Swiss American Trading Corporation, an author, economist, lecturer, former talk show host, articulate spokesman for the privatization of Social Security. And, Craig, we got a few phone calls here. We've got about five minutes in this segment here. Let's take a few of them. Helen in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Helen, welcome. You're live with Craig.
Well, when I hear people like Craig saying the things that he says, I only think he's uninformed because he couldn't possibly realize what people went through when we got Social Security. I was a little child, but I well remember the conditions. And I didn't live in Eureka at that time. I lived in the Midwest.
Yeah, the elderly in the 1930s had the highest rate of poverty, and there were hundreds of thousands of people throughout the 30s, elderly people, who literally died of starvation.
That's right.
And the public outrage over this is what brought about Social Security.
And I now live on railroad retirement, which is same thing but different.
Yeah.
caller, Matt, might I say, Helen, that I haven't been allowed, Helen, to articulate my ideas yet on what I think needs to be done to fix Social Security, so it's pretty hard for you to understand what my position is.
Okay, well, why don't you do that right now?
I haven't had the opportunity to share it yet.
Go for it. Go for it.
Well, you have the first off, Tom, I'd like to say that, you know, your allegations that the only reason I'm suggesting we privatize Social Security is to supply the economic world with a new way to make money is, I'm sure there's some that want to do that, but that's not my intention. First off, if we go about this the proper way, and Daniel Patrick Moynihan brought this up, Paul Samuelson brought this up, Alan Greenspan brought this up, Harvard grads brought, not just Craig Smith. There is a way to do this, Tom, without causing any change of benefits whatsoever to the people like Helen, and being able to at the same time give new people that are just going to work the ability to take the 6.2% that the government now takes to the side and puts in accounts. So you talked about this Social Security Trust Fund that we're soon going to be tapping on it. I hate to break it to your listeners, but there is no money in that trust fund. There are IOUs to $11.4 trillion. We're going to have to borrow that money, and that's why Social Security has to be addressed, Tom.
Well, and this is the fiscal irrationality and insanity of the last, you know, 10 administrations.
Oh, I don't disagree with that at all.
But
I mean, we've done a terrible look. Social Security, in the way that it was designed, as much as I don't like it, it was a good program. However, when you took the money, the excesses that came in that were supposed to be put in trust funds, and you allowed the government to spend that money freely, and now we don't have that money to cover, we can't just get mad about it and say, well, they better cover it because they made us a promise.
Well, no, you can raise taxes. I mean, this here's the very
reality. It's kind of like Paul Krugman right now. Paul Krugman's out there saying Social Security is the most successful government program we've ever had. Well, back in 1986, he said it was a giant Ponzi scheme. You can't have it both ways. And if you look at Paul Samuelson, who's a Nobel Peace Prize winner when it comes to economics, he refers to Social Security as a giant Ponzi scheme as well. But there is a way to fix it, Tom, without hurting current beneficiaries, with being able to bring. Yes, there's going to be some upfront costs, and that's the big crisis right now. Everybody's
Craig, we're going to let you. We're going to let you lay that out right after this break. We're talking with Craig Smith, the president of the Swiss American Trading Corporation, Craig R. Smith, economist, author, lecturer, and president of Swiss American Trading. 29 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Radio Program, and Ed in California, hang in line. We'll get you your call too.
You've supported her through every accomplishment in her life.
Cross, pull, I tied my shoes.
While your ultimate goal is to teach her to stand on her own.
Let go, I can do it.
There are things she just can't do without your support.
There were drugs and alcohol at the party.
Talk with the teens in your life. And if they're in substance abuse treatment and recovery, support them. Help them turn the hardest thing they've ever done into their greatest accomplishment. For information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP.
Time furnished by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
As the AARP gears up to spend more than $5 million to oppose plans by the Bush administration to begin privatizing Social Security, Karl Rove is stepping up to shape the president's public relations campaign. According to the Washington Post, Rove, with the help of White House official Charles P. Blauhaus, planned to raise anywhere from $50 million to $100 million to convince the American people that the president's Social Security initiative needs to be enacted. The new plan would allow younger workers to invest part of their Social Security contribution into the stock market. The NAACP, AFL-CIO, and National Organization of Women have all said they oppose plans to privatize Social Security and are coordinating with Democratic leaders in Congress. On the other side of the aisle, conservative groups like Club for Growth and Progress for America are raising funds alongside corporate trade associations like the National Association of Manufacturers. Many corporations that support privatization have already begun sending money to a group called the Alliance for Worker Retirement Security. Bush is expected to go public with his plans later this month. The coming Social Security fight will be one of the biggest public policy battles in years.
The Republican-dominated National Labor Relations Board has issued a string of rulings tilting in favor of employers over workers. The decisions have made it more difficult for temporary workers to organize unions and have made it easier for employers to use lockouts against workers, among other things. These decisions have been party-line votes, with Republicans opposing the positions taken by workers. Cornell professor James Gross, an author of several books about the NLRB, says these decisions are fundamentally inconsistent with the purpose of the NLRB, which is to encourage collective bargaining.
The union representing police officers in Orlando, Florida, filed a lawsuit against that city's mayor last week, demanding records of his travel expenses and cell phone usage. The officers, represented by the Fraternal Order of Police, are currently involved in bitter contract negotiations with Mayor Buddy Dyer and are demanding his public records to seek out any wrongdoing. The police union has also taken the fight to the sky, flying a banner behind a plane during the Citrus Bowl parade that said, "Mayor Dyer, show police your public record. It's the law." According to the mayor's office, the records have been available for review for months, but no one from the union had asked if they were done. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Employers gave workers less paid holidays in 2004 than in recent years. With both Christmas and New Year's Day falling on Saturdays, only 33% of firms in a recent survey said they gave workers three or more paid holidays. In 1999, the last time those holidays fell on a Saturday, 50% of organizations reported that they gave their employees three or more paid holidays. The service industry is the worst when it came to giving paid holidays last year. Only 18% gave three or more.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We call when I
I said I'd leave no child behind. I guess I changed my mind. Luckily, I bribed you with my tax cut con. The rich got richer, soon the surplus was gone. Prosperity replaced by unemployment and debt. Who could ask for more? It may take amnesia for me to still please you in 2004.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Craig, isn't this really the bottom line that George W. Bush right now does not want to acknowledge the fact that last year, for example, we had a $6 billion deficit, not a $4 billion and change on both counts deficit, because he spent $2 billion of the Social Security surplus, and that he's not, of course, the first president to do that. Bill Clinton was doing it before him. George Senior, Bush Sr. was doing it before that. Ronald Reagan was doing it before that. And that the spending by the Social Security Trust Fund not having the lockbox that Al Gore was arguing for, that what these guys have been able to do is they've been able to minimize the deficits and misstate the actual debt of the United States. And
you're absolutely correct.
Okay, I mean, so
you're right on the button. Matter of fact, U.S. Comptroller David Walker made that very clear back in January of last year, when he said, in the case of Social Security and Medicare trust funds, the federal government took in taxpayer money, spent it on other items, and replaced it with IOUs. And given that fact, he didn't understand, Tom, why we didn't show that as a liability of the U.S. government.
Yeah, I agree that we should be. And in fact, those IOUs are interest-paying IOUs. So Social Security is actually earning interest. I mean, it's invested in T-bills, essentially, and for all practical purposes. And in fact, I'm assuming you saw the piece in the Christian Science Monitor a couple of days ago where this guy who'd retired compared his 45 years in the workplace, what he would have made if he had put that money into the Dow, the top 500 of the Dow versus Social Security. And Social Security actually came out ahead.
Right. If the money was there, the problem is Social Security never invested the money. See, I would agree with you
they did invest the money. They invested.
If we had stayed with the original plan of Social Security, I wouldn't have a problem with it. I'm not crazy about it, but I wouldn't have a problem.
But here's my point, Craig. We did invest the money. We invested it in U.S. government debt. In other words, the government borrowed from itself. One division of the government borrowed from another division. But we did invest the money. We invested it in U.S. government debt. And the U.S. government has to pay that debt back at some point. And George W. Bush right now is facing two choices. Number one, three choices. Number one, he could just ignore this and leave it for the next president, because it's really not going to be a problem for another 40 years or so. I mean, it's going to become a political problem in 12 years, in 15 years.
Right. I agree with that.
Okay. So number one, he could just pass the buck. Number two, he could say, hey guys, we have been borrowing out of the federal government. The amount of borrowing that I've been telling you that we've been borrowing is nonsense. We've really borrowed much more than that. And we're going to have to raise taxes. You know, Bush's...
Or raise the age that you retire at, or reduce the benefits.
Cut benefits. Yeah, right.
Right.
One or the other. Number three, he can say, let's perform a magic trick. Let's fiddle with this thing so much that we don't have to admit to the American people that we've been lying to them, that we've been doing funny numbers, and let's sell this based on it's going to be good for young people. And, I mean, why do you want to give him a political pass? It seems to me that's what this is all about.
I don't. And let me tell you, I'm a registered Republican, voted for Bush both times, but I don't give him a pass on this, okay? And you're right. He has taken $2 trillion out of the lockboxes, just like prior presidents. And I'm not making any excuses for that. What I'm trying to say is that it is broken. It has to be fixed. And privatization is a way that it can be fixed, Tom, if it's done the proper way. Most people don't realize that there's about 5 million American state and local government workers, which represent 3.5% of our workforce, that are totally exempt from Social Security tax.
Yeah, and I don't think they should
be. They changed the actuarial tables by 24%.
I agree. I don't think that they should be. You know, I think that they should be part of Social Security. I think that we're saying the same thing.
Okay, but you and I agree on that. That would change the actuarial tables by 11%.
But
Agree. Hang on. Let's see if we agree on some other things. The current method of taxing benefits is illogical. It's inequitable. It's confusing. If we started taxing Social Security benefits in the same way we tax other pension benefits, as much as 24% of the actuarial tables would be eliminated. Would you agree with that?
No, because Social Security is not a retirement fund.
What is it, then?
It's an insurance policy. A large percentage of what Social Security is paying out is not
to
retired people.
But insurance is only necessary if you have an accident. What about the... Okay, then let's talk about...
What if the accident is that your husband, who worked all his life and you were working in your home, dies?
You should have a benefit. I'm not
then we're talking about an insurance program, not a retirement program.
Okay, then let's take that and let's take it one step forward. Let's look at means testing. If you don't need that insurance, let's say your husband died and he left you $50 million, and you don't need that $1,500 a month, should you still get it?
There you and I probably agree. I think that there should be some means testing with Social Security.
Well, that changes the actuarial tables by 60%, Tom.
I agree. Well, it depends on where you put the threshold of those means. I mean, it is possible.
I did a white paper on this where we spent 1,000 man hours researching it. And people that are listening to the Hartman program and the Tom Hartman program, if they call 800-289-2646, we'll do it where there's no cost to your listeners. Read the information that we've put together on it, and this paper does not propose privatization of Social Security.
Okay,
Tom.
That's fine, Craig. You're because we do have private insurance. We do have private retirement programs right now. We have 401ks. We have SEPs. We have there's a whole variety of ways that people can retire for their investment, tax free, in fact.
And
they're more efficient than Social Security would be. But here's my problem with what you're proposing.
I don't think people should be out on the street, Tom.
Here's my problem with what you're proposing, Craig. We have a regressive Social Security tax. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates pay the same amount of Social Security tax as somebody making $90,000
right,
a year.
Right.
Do you think that's right?
No.
Okay. So if we were to say the $89,500 cap on Social Security tax is simply going to go away, just like with income taxes, as much money as you make, you pay a tax on it. You can make as much money as you want in America. You can make $100 million a year. We think that's wonderful, but you're going to have to pay a tax on it because you're a member of the society. You've got the blessings of the society. You get to pay into it because we have this thing called the social contract. We're all in this together. If we simply eliminated the cap, the problem of Social Security is solved.
No, but it's not that simple, Tom.
Yes, it is.
Let me ask you something. Another way to resolve it, too, is to start taking people off the rolls. Let's say I'm a 25-year-old
person.
No, but
why? Wait a second. Why not just eliminate the cap? Why not make the Social Security tax? Why keep the Social Security tax something that only working-class and middle-class people pay?
Why
keep Social Security exempt for rich people?
Wait a minute. If you're talking about freedom here, which it sounds like you are, why would you want to hold me into a program that I don't want to be in? If I was willing to say to you, I'll tell you what.
Because you're part of society.
No.
Yes, Tom, you are. You absolutely are. Craig, you are part of society. It's the same reason that I think that you should pay for the roads that we all use, even if you don't use those roads, even if you don't own a car. You say you live in New York City and you just walk around. I still think you should pay for those roads because you're deriving some benefit from them.
Sure,
you and I are both deriving... You and I are both deriving benefit from the fact that elderly people are not dying of starvation. It's not even the altruistic part of it. It's the fact that they're not standing
Tom,
in front of your house with their hand out begging for food.
Tom, nobody dies of starvation if Social Security's not there. Come on, let's not...
They were in the 1930s, Craig. They were in the 1930s.
Right, exactly. And they came up with a program to address that so people didn't have that happen. But we're not in the 30s anymore, Tom. We're in 2005.
And we have more bankruptcies now in absolute numbers than we had in the 1930s. We are sliding backwards very, very rapidly in terms of the average income, the average income for the average, median family. I mean, we've got some serious problems here. Craig, let's take some phone calls on this. I mean, we have a difference of opinion on this. You think privatization is the best way. I think eliminating the
capitalism. No, I don't think that. You keep saying that. I think that
partial
privatization...
Well, that's what this news release that was sent to me says.
Hang on a minute. I believe that partial privatization and that you should be able to give a person the ability to opt out, take 6.2% that they're paying in right now and allow them to divert it to a private account. The other 6.2% should stay in and continue to fuel things. I have no problem with that. But, Tom, we used to have 35 workers paying in for every one person taking out. We now have 3 workers paying in for every one person taking out. Soon it's going to be 2 people for every one person taking out.
And then it's going to go back to 35, Craig.
Estimation, it can't survive.
No. what you're ignoring, you're looking at a 30-year event horizon with regard to demographics and an infinite or a 75-year event horizon when you toss out the numbers, or at least the Bush administration is. Those cycles are going to come back around again.
Alan Greenspan is using.
Yeah, Alan Greenspan, the guy who was initiated into the cult of objectivism in Ayn Rand's apartment in New York City in 1962. I don't consider Alan Greenspan an articulate spokesman for this. Let's take a few phone calls here.
Warren Buffett feels the same way, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'd have to hear that from him. Ed in California is on the line. Ed, hey, what's your contribution to this?
Hey, Craig, a couple of things. First of all, it's not the program that's wrong. It's the government spending that's wrong.
I agree wholeheartedly.
And second of all, I'm one of these guys. I'm sorry. It's not as much fun as it sounds, but I'm 58 and I'm going blind. And I need Social Security because, you see, in the last 15 years, every company I worked for was either gobbled up by another company and I lost my benefits or went bankrupt.
But you're going to get your benefits on Social Security,
but
sir.
In a few years, you know something? You Enron types, you never leave us anything.
Well, wait a minute, you Enron types. What is this all about? I have 75 employees that I've never laid one person off in 23 years. They all got Christmas bonuses. They all have health insurance. They all have pension plans. What is this, you Enron types?
You're part of the stock market and you believe that we should privatize.
I'm not part of the stock market, sir. I buy and sell gold coins for a living. Matter of fact, I'm totally opposed to the stock market. I believe the stock market is a game of chance, that they take people's monies like yours and play games with them. Take your futures and play games with it. I think apparently.
Then why should we why should we put part of Social Security into it then, Craig?
I'm suggesting that the half that you get, that you should be able to invest as you see fit. Doesn't particularly have to be in the stock market. I heard your news break was talking about the stock market. I think maybe it should go in inflation indexed bonds.
Yeah, or gold.
Or maybe it should go in inflation index treasury bills.
Yeah.
Yes, a small portion of it should go into gold, 5-10%.
And I'm an advocate of that, actually. Let's move along.
Only because if we had not left the gold standard, and this is a whole other argument.
Yeah, I know.
We would have never had this problem.
Well,
that
was something that was debated for over 150 years in the United States, the gold standard, and let's not go there because that's a whole nother hour discussion. Lynn in Eureka, California has a question for you. Hey, Lynn, welcome to the program.
Hi. I hear you both saying that you're kind of for means testing, and I think that's a bad idea because what ends up happening then is we have another program for the poor, and the poor have no voice in Washington, and suddenly it's very weakened or gone.
Yeah, well, my concern with means testing, I don't disagree with you, Lynn. My concern with means testing is that people are going to get a hold of it and they're going to say, oh, here's where the threshold should be. And we're seeing a situation right now. We just went through this with my wife's grandmother, who died at the age of 94 a couple of years ago, where in order to get Medicare, she had to essentially liquidate everything she owned. She had to become poor, and she already was poor because the things that she owned were not liquid, but she had to wipe. Families are getting wiped out. There's this huge process of converting assets into nothing, and I'm concerned.
That's actually a bigger problem, Tom, is Medicare.
Well, yeah, it's a whole other thing. I mean, this is Medicaid, but that's my concern about means testing, and so I'm not in favor of means testing, but I am in favor of a discussion of it.
Let me tell you where I think it could be helpful, Tom, is if people like Buffett and Gates and myself, I'm on public record on this, on a number of different programs, that I have no intention of taking a Social Security check when I retire a few years from now. I already have my future planned. I've already got it well taken care of. I have no intentions of taking it.
Well, take it and give it to a good charity.
Give it to somebody who needs it.
Yeah, okay. Well, you can do that. I mean, there's lots of people out there who need it.
They need to do that, though. We need to have those voices step up and say that.
1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Roland in Berlin, Germany is on the line. Hey, Roland, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello. Actually, I was having a totally different issue here. I was just meeting a group of people from the youth movement from La Rouche,
uh-huh,
tabling on the street, and actually I just wanted to hear some views on LaRouche from
what,
you.
What is this all about? Yeah, yeah, it is off topic, Roland. Tell you what, yeah. call in when we don't have a guest on a particular topic, and we'll get into it. Let me do a little more research. Rama wants me to tell you that WLYM.com is the Youth Movement for LaRouche's website, and I'm not going to go any farther with that. I don't want to get into it right now. But Roland, give us a call
some
other time. We'll get into it. Thanks. LaRouche is to politics what Reverend Moon is to religion, in my mind. But you know,
Amen.
Maybe I'm wrong. 1-866-889-8894.
We agree on something.
There's a lot we agree on, Craig. It's just, you know, this privatization.
And look, I like a lively debate. Let me tell you why. This is exactly what needs to be happening in Washington.
I agree. This is what needs to be happening all across America, and it's not because we have corporate-controlled media. Florian in Arlington Heights, Illinois, listening to WINI, I'm assuming, is on the line. Hey, Florian, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you.
We only have a minute and a half left, by the way.
Pardon?
We only have a minute and a half left, so make your question quick.
Basically, the CBO released in July their analysis of the Plan 2, okay? And its end result was a reduction in GDP from our current 5%, which is historically what we've been collecting from everybody, down to 2% of GDP in the year 2105, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's a plan that was released, a CBO analysis released December 22nd.
Florian, I've got to ask you to just cut to the chase.
Okay, Diamond Orsag is the name of the plan, okay?
Yeah, yeah. What's your point?
It shows a means, without reducing benefits substantially, to ultimately take the 5% GDP value up to a total of 6%.
Right.
In other words,
it's just saving a slight
Social Security without privatization is going to cost us 1% of GDP over the next 100 years.
Yeah, in other words,
this is a
phony issue in some folks' mind. We got to wrap it up. Craig Smith, thanks for being with us. Craig, I know you've
great
got points to make.
Time, and I'll tell you that white paper is available at 800-289-2646.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555. And mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's The Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show absolutely without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews.
What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
The Clean Air Act is due for an update, according to the author of a new book about air. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. President Kennedy signed the Clean Air Act into law in 1963. Author Joe Sherman says a number of factors made it politically possible to pass a federal law attacking pollution, a subject that until then had been left to the states. Sherman is the author of a new book called Gasp, The Swift and Terrible Beauty of Air. He says air pollution had killed 4,000 people in London over a four-day period in 1952. Then Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, a book that helped spark the modern environmental movement.
Silent Spring, Carson's book, gave Kennedy a lot of boost. It brought air issues into the public agenda. And Kennedy really pushed the first Clean Air Act through. It didn't have a lot of enforcement muscle. It took until 1970 for that to happen.
The act was amended again in 1977 and 1990. But Sherman says problems have arisen over the last 14 years that should prompt another look at the law.
It has not been amended again, but it struggles to kind of deal with the air pollution situation America keeps making bigger. It has a lot of very good features to it. But it basically is an institutional device, has fallen behind the kind of extent of the pollutants we have. It doesn't deal at all with global warming, which now has become, I call it the big worry in my book. It's particularly indicative of how our institutions have failed to keep up with the realities of pollution.
Sherman says global warming, caused in part by air pollution, could become the biggest force of change humans have ever had to face. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, what's wrong with this picture? You take a perfectly good Social Security system that's been paying benefits for 70 years. And hand a good chunk of it off to your buddies in Wall Street.
What's wrong with this picture?
And you wonder why Argentina went bankrupt when they privatized their social security system, or England had to put caps on it, the UK, because so many people were profiteering so badly. The reality is 37% of Social Security's beneficiaries, over a third, 37% of Social Security's beneficiaries are not retired workers. This is a reality the Bush administration would have you forget. Almost 45 million Americans right now collect payments from Social Security. Over one-third of them, almost 17 million, are not retired workers. Among those currently receiving Social Security payments are 5 million spouses and children of retired and disabled workers, 7 million spouses and dependent children of deceased workers, and 5 million disabled workers. So, number one, to privatize Social Security, or to, partially privatize it. Number one would, in my opinion, and the opinion of some good, solid economists, the Century Foundation put together an absolutely brilliant brief on this. And I don't have a URL for this thing. It must be a PDF file. I hate PDF files. But in any case, I'm guessing if you plug Century Foundation and Social Security into Google, you'll find it. Number one, today's insurance to protect workers and their families against death and disability would be threatened because it's an insurance program, not an investment program. And 37% of those people receiving it are receiving insurance payments, not retirement payments. Number two, creating private accounts makes Social Security's financing problems worse, not better. The Bush administration knows this. They don't want you to know it. Number three, and you know, I could lay out all the numbers. It's just blindingly boring. You go through the numbers. But Paul Krugman has written a brilliant piece about this. It's on truthout.org right now, by the way. Number three, creating private accounts could dampen economic growth. It'll escalate federal deficits and debt, and this is not going to help the economy. This is not going to help the United States. Privatization has not worked in other countries where they've tried it. In Chile, for example, it was a major disappointment, even though the Wall Street Journal was touting it, the Chilean privatization. Today, more than half of all workers are excluded from even a semblance of a safety net in their old age in Chile. Now, this is what happened in Chile. Yeah, they privatized it, and it worked out great for the rich folks. End of discussion. Is that what we want here? I don't think so. I really believe we have a social contract in this country. We are willing to say we will take care of those who have fallen through the cracks. Partly because it's the right thing to do. Partly because we don't want them on our doorsteps with their hand out begging of us. Right? I mean, if you can frame it as a Christian thing or a Jewish thing or a selfish thing.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
In either case, it makes sense. End of discussion.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
As the AARP gears up to spend more than $5 million to oppose plans by the Bush administration to begin privatizing Social Security, Karl Rove is stepping up to shape the president's public relations campaign. According to the Washington Post, Rove, with the help of White House official Charles P. Blauhaus, planned to raise anywhere from $50 million to $100 million to convince the American people that the president's Social Security initiative needs to be enacted. The new plan would allow younger workers to invest part of their Social Security contribution into the stock market. Then AACP, AFL-CIO, and National Organization of Women have all said they oppose plans to privatize Social Security and are coordinating with Democratic leaders in Congress. On the other side of the aisle, conservative groups like Club for Growth and Progress for America are raising funds alongside corporate trade associations like the National Association of Manufacturers. Many corporations that support privatization have already begun sending money to a group called the Alliance for Worker Retirement Security. Bush is expected to go public with his plans later this month. The coming Social Security fight will be one of the biggest public policy battles in years.
The Republican-dominated National Labor Relations Board has issued a string of rulings tilting in favor of employers over workers. The decisions have made it more difficult for temporary workers to organize unions and have made it easier for employers to use lockouts against workers, among other things. These decisions have been party-line votes, with Republicans opposing the positions taken by workers. Cornell professor James Gross, an author of several books about the NLRB, says these decisions are fundamentally inconsistent with the purpose of the NLRB, which is to encourage collective bargaining.
The union representing police officers in Orlando, Florida, filed a lawsuit against that city's mayor last week, demanding records of his travel expenses and cell phone usage. The officers, represented by the Fraternal Order of Police, are currently involved in bitter contract negotiations with Mayor Buddy Dyer and are demanding his public records to seek out any wrongdoing. The police union has also taken the fight to the sky, flying a banner behind a plane during the Citrus Bowl parade that said, "Mayor Dyer, show police your public record. It's the law." According to the mayor's office, the records have been available for review for months, but no one from the union had asked if they were done. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Employers gave workers less paid holidays in 2004 than in recent years. With both Christmas and New Year's Day falling on Saturdays, only 33% of firms in a recent survey said they gave workers three or more paid holidays. In 1999, the last time those holidays fell on a Saturday, 50% of organizations reported that they gave their employees three or more paid holidays. The service industry is the worst when it came to giving paid holidays last year. Only 18% gave three or more.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org. Or call 215-563-7110.
When challenged directly by a crowd of America's troops about the Bushites' ongoing damnable failure to provide adequate armor for our soldiers, Pentagon Chief Donnie Rumsfeld was momentarily speechless. As the crowd murmured, Rummy said, "Now settle down, hell, I'm an old man, it's early in the morning and I'm gathering my thoughts here." If any of the Bushites need clarity on the scandalous way they treat our soldiers, they need only visit Army Specialist Robert Loria of Middletown, New York. Last February, he was in one of Rumsfeld's unprotected Humvees when it was hit by a roadside bomb in Iraq. Loria's left hand and forearm were blasted off and shrapnel ripped through his body. He spent months in rehab trying to learn how to live without a hand. Finally, just before this Christmas, he was due to be released and return home when he was hit with another bomb. Rumsfeld's Pentagon presented Loria with a bill for $1,700, claiming he had erroneously received family separation pay while in rehab, plus travel expenses connected to his treatment. Also, they billed him for some of the Humvee parts damaged in the bombing that tore off his hand. Loria was devastated, but the Army brass didn't care, demanding payment before they would release him. Hello, the Halliburtons rip off billions from us taxpayers, but the Pentagon is hounding the grunts. "It's almost like I'm being abandoned," Loria said. "Like, you did your job for us, and now you're no use. That's how it feels." Is that clear enough for you, Mr. Rumsfeld? Thanks to press coverage and intervention by some members of Congress, Loria's nightmarish treatment by the Pentagon has finally ended. The Army was forced to clear Loria's hokey debt and send him home. This is Jim Hightower saying, but why should a soldier who's made such an extreme sacrifice be treated so shabbily in the first place? And how many others are getting the same back of the hand?
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac. The libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what. Support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library. So make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
For our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, welcome back, my friends. That was quite a row we had there in the last hour about Social Security. It really is one of the most critical issues of our time. Whether or not we're going to hand trillions of dollars, our dollars, over to George W. Bush's buddies on Wall Street. Whether we're going to do like Chile did and create a privatized system where the wealthy do very, very well, thank you very much, and more than half the population gets not enough to live on. You know, just poverty is exploding. It's a terrible problem. Privatizing Social Security in Argentina bankrupted the nation. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. Privatization of part of the Social Security program, or the equivalent, in the UK led to such profiteering on the part of those corporations that the government had to step in and put a cap on how much they could charge. Why should we take a program that the government doesn't charge us to administer? They don't have to pay dividends to their stockholders. They don't have to pay multi-million dollar salaries to a CEO. They don't have to have a fleet of corporate jets or corporate headquarters. Why should we take a program that is just run by nice, boring bureaucrats and has never failed to pay a check and hand it over to private corporations? This religion of privatization, and it is a religion, my friends, pure and simple. It is a belief system. It was Paul, I believe, in Romans or Ephesians. You know, faith is belief in those things unseen. It is a religion. It is a belief in something that has never been demonstrated. Yes, there are some things. Of course, there are some things that private corporations do more efficiently than government. I don't want the government making my shoes. I don't want the government making my cars. I don't want the government in the home building business. I don't want there's a million things the government should not be doing and doesn't do. But there are things I would rather have the government do, and I would rather have them do it very efficiently in a very nice, boring, efficient fashion where nobody's getting rich off it. I'd like to have them run my police department. I'd like to have them make sure that my fire department is here. I'd like to have them keep my streets functional. I'd like to have them make sure that the pharmaceuticals I take are safe, that the food supply, the food that I'm eating is not going to kill me, that my water is clean and pure, that the sewage that my house produces is disposed of in a way that doesn't harm people downstream. And I'd like to know that if I have a problem, that Social Security is there. 37% of Social Security recipients are not retired workers. It is an insurance program, not a retirement program. And no matter how much Bush wants to hand off these trillions of dollars to his buddies on Wall Street so they can get even wealthier, he can't hide that fact. Anyhow, enough about that. We ranted about that for an hour. I just wanted to wrap that up. There was a piece that I published on Common Dreams last week that I think is one of the more important that I've written over the years, not by way of patting myself on the back, because the most important part of it is actually a quotation from somebody else. And if you go to TomHartman.com and click Articles on Democracy, it's the top article. And the title of it, in fact, is The Myth of National Victimhood, All Wrapped Up and Delivered in Time for Christmas. And the quote is from a German who was interviewed by Milton Mayer. Milton Mayer wrote, "They thought they were free." He was a Chicago reporter who went to Germany immediately after World War II and spent several years living there and interviewing Germans, average Germans, some of them Jewish, many of them not, and asking them, how did this happen? How is it that you allowed Hitler to attack Poland and claim that Poland had weapons of mass destruction and was intending to attack Germany when, in fact, they weren't, and thus kick off World War II? How did you allow that to happen? How did you allow the murder of the Jews to happen, and the Gypsies and the Catholics and the gays and, you know, the pink triangles, the yellow? How did you allow that to happen? Or the pink stars, was it, whichever it was. And in the last paragraph of this quote from this book from Mayer, there was this German academic. He was a professor in a college, and he was talking about how there were all these changes, but they were all, you know, they were these little small changes, and you kept waiting for some big thing that would cause the nation to rise up and say, enough, you know, this Hitler guy is nuts, enough, and the big thing never happened. It was always these little small incremental things, and the totality of them, I mean, if you look over a 10-year period, you see there's been a big change here, but one by one, they weren't, none of them were enough. And he says, and one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy. And some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, Jew swine, collapses it all at once. And you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made a lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear. And the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. Which brings us to today's press release from the Westboro Baptist Church. I first encountered these people here in Montpelier, Vermont. It was the week that the Vermont legislature, this was, as I recall, about 5 or 6 years ago, must have been more than that, actually. Must have been more like 7 or 8. It's been a while now. I'm not sure exactly when it happened. But anyhow, it was the week that the Vermont legislature was debating whether or not to pass the civil unions bill, which we have here, which allows gays and lesbians to marry. And I was walking down the street. I live about 8 blocks from the state capitol. Walking down the street and walking by the state capitol, and here's about 20 people standing out in front holding up these signs that say things like God hates gays and fags are going to burn in hell and stuff like this. I mean, just the most disgusting, despicable, hate-filled stuff. And I was like, you know, and they were passing out literature. It's like, who are you people? What? And there was this guy, and he had a bullhorn, and he was talking about how the legislators and Howard Dean, the governor, would burn in hell if they passed this legislation. And his name was Fred Phelps, and he was the minister of this church, this Baptist church. And I just, you know, I walked on. And then when I was at the Republican National Convention, Louise and I were staying in the apartment of a friend of mine, one of my best friends, Jerry Schneiderman. He lives just down the street from Madison Square Garden on 8th Avenue. And we walked out of the apartment and walked just a block up 8th Avenue. We were about a block and a half away from Madison Square Garden. And there they are again with their signs, protesting gay marriage in Massachusetts, and John Kerry. Well, now they have... See, in Sweden, it is illegal to discriminate against gays. It is so illegal to discriminate against gays that a Swedish court actually recently sent a Swedish minister to jail for a month for the crime of preaching that gays should be killed from the pulpit. They sent him inciting violence against gays. Well, that didn't sit well with Fred Phelps. So here's the news release, dated December 29th. Last Thursday, last Friday? Whatever day it was, Wednesday, I don't have a calendar in front of me. Anyhow, last week, the headline, "Thank God for Tsunami and 2,000 Dead Swedes," followed by 3 exclamation points. The first paragraph, "How many tsunami dead Swedes are fags and dykes?" Question mark. "Vacationing on their fat, expendable incomes without kids to bother with and spend money on. With respect to each of these earthquake dead perverts, he shall be buried with the burial of an ass," Jeremiah 22:19. He goes on to say, "Sweden is under God's silent, irresistible, irreversible curse." And then they quote from Isaiah 51:8, for the moth shall eat them up like a garment, and the worm shall eat them like wool. And then he goes on to say, "The earthquake was a small adumbration of worse things to come for Sweden. Woe to faggot Swedes." I'm telling you, my friends, Fred Phelps has gone from being the lunatic fringe to being part of the underground Republican mainstream. We have reached the point in the United States where censorship is the norm, where the media is afraid to speak out for fear of losing access to the president, where it is considered acceptable in the mainstream media to have reasonable discussions about whether, for example, gays should have civil rights. We are at that point that Milton Mayer talked about. I'm telling you, we are at that point. He said, "The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring, the houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear. And the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves." Reichwing Talk Radio. The spread of the Fox News Channel, the Michael Savage, and this just extraordinary expulsion of hate and fear, and some of it on the left as well, but the vast majority of it on the right, grounded in bigotry and hatred. We must awaken from this. If we do not awaken from this, our nation is doomed. I'm not talking about the wrath of God. I'm talking about just plain old, good old-fashioned social collapse. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush O, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews.
What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more involved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
I spent years learning to cope with my mental health problems and just as long conquering substance addiction. But I did both, and I'm incredibly proud. But with the world and everything going on today, I get so overwhelmed. It's so tempting to turn to drugs and alcohol to help me escape. I don't want all of my accomplishments to just go away.
If you or someone you know is abusing drugs and alcohol to cope, get information and treatment referral at 1-800-662-HELP.
Time furnished by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Hey! And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room and find one of the most intelligent, articulate, thoughtful, insightful, brilliant, occasionally wild, wacky, and even sexy chats on the whole entire internet. No, not sexual, sexy. Yeah, there's a difference. Actually, the discussion last half hour has been mostly about the topics we've been talking about and also about how to get BitTorrent to play so you can watch those videos of the power of nightmares. Another amazing thing. It's time for, by the way, it is time for our daily check-in with Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. This morning, during the morning gaggle at the White House, I asked if President Bush had considered toning down or canceling the inaugural festivities, given that we, quote-unquote, are at war, and secondly, given what's happened with the tsunami.
I'm sure they laughed at you.
Bob McClellan referred me to the inaugural committee.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Even the Washington Times today came up with a list of people who have given to the inaugural committee. Most likely, I would guess, because, you know, the only persons that ever should be inaugurated are Reverend Moon. They said,
who owns the Washington Times? We should, for those listeners who don't realize that Reverend Moon is one of the largest bankrollers of the conservative, the Christian conservative right wing in America, even though he claims to be the successor to Jesus Christ and claims that Jesus Christ failed in his mission and that therefore you should follow Reverend Moon. He is one of the largest bankrollers of the right and one of the largest bankrollers of Papa Bush in his international speaking tours. So pardon my interruption.
Yes. So Richard Kinder, I think that's how he pronounced his name, he is Enron's former president. He is one of the people who has given, there's sort of two tiers, $250,000 and $100,000. And he is definitely one of the people that has given in the $250,000 category. There's 94 people on that list. It is on the Bush inaugural website, so you can take a look at it. But
you know,
of course,
you know, Ellen, we have skipped right over Nero and gone straight to Caligula.
That's a good way of putting it.
I mean, this is incredible.
But, you know, there's also some companies on that, Tom, such as Blue Cross Blue Shield. Why is a healthcare corporation that originally was a nonprofit, it still may be in some states, giving $100,000 to the president's inaugural?
Well, because they don't want there to be national health insurance, because it would harm them if it, you know, if not put them out of business. I mean, it's very simple, right? I mean, they...
Yes, that was sort of a rhetorical question.
I see.
But
okay.
In any case,
I figured you knew that, Ellen.
Is that the House is taking up the ethics rules. Now, it's very interesting. I've had on the radio show with Doug Congressman Joel Heftley on for 12 years once a week. Mm. So I know the head of the Ethics Committee extremely well.
Right.
And even though he's a right-wing Republican,
yeah.
And I disagree with him on lots of things, he's one of the most ethical people I know.
Hmm.
And... he is in charge of the Ethics Committee. Well, they're the ones that went after DeLay. So
yeah.
Now...
They're trying to bounce him out, aren't they?
They are thinking of bouncing Joel Heffley out.
Yeah. We only have a minute left, Ellen. Something I've got to share. I want to get your take on. On Thursday, the electoral vote is going to be opened, and there may or may not be a senator who challenges along with Conyers. By coincidence, the Republicans have scheduled Thursday for Gonzalez's hearings in the hopes, I think, that the Democrats will bring up Abu Ghraib and maybe even show some graphic footage to grab the headlines. Do you think that they are willing to, that they're sacrificing, you know, they're willing to embarrass Gonzalez? It's not going to hurt his nomination in order to keep the Electoral College vote from being news.
Honestly, I wish I could say that was the case, but I think that they think that there's going to be such a minor challenge in their view to the Electoral College, and I don't think they're going to get a senator on their side at this point like they didn't last time, another subject for a movie. But I honestly think that was not perfectly scheduled that way. I think that...
So I'm more of a conspiracy nut than I thought I was.
Yeah, on that one, I think you are.
Okay. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Always wonderful to hear from you, Ellen. Thanks so much for your daily reports.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you again tomorrow. Have a great one. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oreck, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oreck XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oreck XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
As the AARP gears up to spend more than $5 million to oppose plans by the Bush administration to begin privatizing Social Security, Karl Rove is stepping up to shape the president's public relations campaign. According to the Washington Post, Rove, with the help of White House official Charles P. Blumhouse, planned to raise anywhere from $50 million to $100 million to convince the American people that the president's Social Security initiative needs to be enacted. The new plan would allow younger workers to invest part of their Social Security contribution into the stock market. The NAACP, AFL-CIO, and National Organization of Women have all said they oppose plans to privatize Social Security and are coordinating with Democratic leaders in Congress. On the other side of the aisle, conservative groups like Club for Growth and Progress for America are raising funds alongside corporate trade associations like the National Association of Manufacturers. Many corporations that support privatization have already begun sending money to a group called the Alliance for Worker Retirement Security. Bush is expected to go public with his plans later this month. The coming Social Security fight will be one of the biggest public policy battles in years.
The Republican-dominated National Labor Relations Board has issued a string of rulings tilting in favor of employers over workers. The decisions have made it more difficult for temporary workers to organize unions and have made it easier for employers to use lockouts against workers, among other things. These decisions have been party-line votes, with Republicans opposing the positions taken by workers. Cornell professor James Gross, an author of several books about the NLRB, says these decisions are fundamentally inconsistent with the purpose of the NLRB, which is to encourage collective bargaining.
The union representing police officers in Orlando, Florida, filed a lawsuit against that city's mayor last week, demanding records of his travel expenses and cell phone usage. The officers, represented by the Fraternal Order of Police, are currently involved in bitter contract negotiations with Mayor Buddy Dyer and are demanding his public records to seek out any wrongdoing. The police union has also taken the fight to the sky, flying a banner behind a plane during the Citrus Bowl parade that said, "Mayor Dyer, show police your public record. It's the law." According to the mayor's office, the records have been available for review for months, but no one from the union had asked if they were done. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Employers gave workers less paid holidays in 2004 than in recent years. With both Christmas and New Year's Day falling on Saturdays, only 33% of firms in a recent survey said they gave workers three or more paid holidays. In 1999, the last time those holidays fell on a Saturday, 50% of organizations reported that they gave their employees three or more paid holidays. The service industry is the worst when it came to giving paid holidays last year. Only 18% gave three or more.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website. Was just handed this exclusive. According to IDAO's own sources in Baghdad and Sulaymaniyah, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has been arrested in Baguba by U.S. forces. Well, that's interesting. That'll be big news. The U.S. occupation forces will cite this arrest as a victory for their war on terrorism. People in Fallujah and their demonstrations demanding U.S. withdrawal of the last few days, which have topped 30,000 people, according to new news agency reports. Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. This is the Arab press I'm sharing with you here. They're claiming that over 30,000 people have demonstrated in Fallujah demanding that the U.S. get out. Who knows? I mean, you know, it may or may not be. People of Fallujah have repeatedly accused U.S. forces of using Zarqawi as a pretext to demolish a city of 300,000 in an attempt to quell its resistance to the occupation. Many in the Iraqi resistance have expressed opposition to Zarqawi's methods in the past. He's regarded as a small force in the anti-occupation movement. Now, I've made that point before. I think that this guy, you know, that the Bush administration has blown this guy up into being a monster so that they can, you know, so that they can have a monster to take on. I mean, it's always... In the mind of the public, it's the point that Superman would be boring if there wasn't Lex Luthor or Kryptonite. Batman would be boring if there were not the Joker and the Juggler and the Iceman. You can't have a superhero without a super criminal. The first rule of fiction, the first thing that you learn when you start writing novels, is that. Or any kind of fiction, really, most kinds of fiction, let's say, drama, or screenplays, is that the protagonist's goodness is always defined by the antagonist's badness. And most people have never even thought of this, and certainly don't realize it. But you know, think about notice this: the next time you go to a movie, the next book you read, the good character can only be as good as the forces against which he or she fights. In other words, you can only demonstrate how good somebody is by how much they do battle against evil and how evil it is. And so for George Bush to make himself, in the public eye, so that he could get reelected in 2004, to make himself into a superhero, into a man of, you know, larger than life, of epic proportions, of great magnitude, of marvelous stuff, that he, in order for him to do this, he had to make sure that his enemies were perceived as being essentially superhuman. And so we have been inflating Zarqawi because Osama bin Laden has been, you know, pretty effectively taken out of the picture. He's, you know, hiding in the borders of Pakistan or Afghanistan, and just, you know, he's just hiding. Occasionally he sends out a press release. He's kind of trying to sound like he's an elder statesman now. Nobody's taking it seriously. So George W. needed a new boogeyman. And there has been a lot of writing, interestingly, in the conservative media as well as the liberal media, about how Zarqawi has, you know, he's in three places at once, he's responsible for, you know, everything in sight, blah-de-blah-de-blah, when in fact he's really just a small-time crook and he's only responsible for a little bit of stuff, and time will tell, time will tell. But this administration has a long history of hyperinflating bad guys. I mean, turning them into larger than life bad guys so that they can say that they have taken them on. So we'll see. I want to get back to this issue of what happens when hate takes over a nation. First, though, we have Harriet in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Harriet, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I don't have anything on that topic. It was just a rant after hearing our fearless leader this morning. Did you hear his speech?
I did not. George W.?
Yep.
What did he say?
He's asking Clinton and his dear old dad to go around, as it says here, in the coming days, the two men will ask Americans to donate directly to reliable charities already providing help to tsunami victims. Where has Bush been?
Well, they've figured out that here's an opportunity for him to look good. The first few days we saw the real Bush, which was, you know, come on, these people aren't Americans. They don't vote. And then they figured out Americans are really upset about this. People are really concerned about it. And so he's jumping on the bandwagon with both feet.
But the thing is, we, the Americans, and this is apolitical, when he was still sitting at 35 million, just the Red Cross alone, people have donated over 40 million.
Yeah.
And I see it as an insult to the people of this country for him to come in so late in the game, appointing his dad and Clinton, I'm surprised Clinton went along with it, to now ask us to contribute. Where does he think we've been?
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a tough one. There is no doubt in my mind that Bush is going to use this to his political advantage.
Yes, yes.
And Bill Clinton would have done the same thing. I mean, it's just, you know, any politician would use it to their political advantage. And so, you know, the first 3 days when Bush was silent.
Yes.
I saw that as a disaster, not only because there were people dying and they needed our help, but also because it was an extraordinary opportunity for the United States to heal some of the damage done to our reputation worldwide,
right,
particularly
right,
in the Muslim and poor world.
And we didn't.
Right.
Yes.
And we didn't, and we failed. And you know, so he's got to undo that. But I think that we have to cut him some slack on this and wish him well, because we really do want there to be a successful assistance to these folks. You know,
well, I do realize that, but yes, he is using it, A, for political gain, and B, to me, he's insulting the people of this country, because, like I say, we've been contributing already.
Yeah, yeah. But it is important, I think, that the president, as a head of state, not just a head of government in the United States, which is unique. I mean, you know, in England, the head of state is the Queen, the head of government is Tony Blair. Here it's both, you know, they're both in one position. And as the head of state, he needs to be stepping out there and saying, let's pull together, let's help out, let's do things, you know, and now he's doing it. And so I think that as much as we may dislike his politics or even him as a person or politician, frankly, I don't know him as a person, but for what I know of him, we still have to say, okay, good, you're doing what needs to be done, and let's do more of it. So, I'm not going to take a bite out of him for this one, Harriet.
I'll let you do it.
But
I'll do one for you.
But I'm not going to. I just don't. I don't see any percentage in it, frankly, over the long term.
I guess my opinion is, or I guess my thing is saying he's telling us basically that we haven't been doing anything. What he should have done is to recognize us too by saying, I'm fully aware that the people of this country have done an absolutely marvelous job of contributing. They've contributed millions of dollars. You know, I can't thank you enough. You know, let's try to do a little more.
Yeah.
Me, that would have gone over a lot better.
Yeah. Well, there's and either one of us could probably fine tune his message in a lot of ways. But he's got, I mean, their focus group testing this. This White House is the most focus grouped White House in the history of presidencies. I mean, it's virtually a daily event that they're doing polls or focus groups at the White House, or at least it was during his first 4 years. I have no reason to assume it's changed. And I'm sure that they have fine tuned this message very, very carefully, and they will continue to. And you know, let's just hope that some good comes out of it for the people of Southeast Asia who were so badly affected.
Yes,
by that.
Yes.
If Bush gets a few political brownie points, I don't frankly care. There are bigger fish to fry. We've got to worry about his taking apart the American economy, about his turning this into a fascist nation, about his stripping us of our civil liberties, about the encouragement of hatred in the United States, about his having during the last 4 years given $1 billion to religious affiliated groups under his so-called faith-based initiatives by way of buying their votes. I mean, there are real issues that are wrong, in my opinion. And so, you know, if he does good with this, I congratulate him for it, frankly.
We shall see.
It's hard to say, right? It's hard to say. But what we want, you know, as much as satisfying as it is to take pot shots at George W. Bush, what we want is for people's lives to be saved in Southeast Asia.
Oh, yes. I'll agree with that 100%.
And so, you know, if it's going to take Bush to make that happen, then so be it. And he is the president of the United States, and it would be nice if our reputation in the world was enhanced a little bit, because we all are Americans, and we are all going to have to deal with this, and our children and grandchildren are going to have to deal with the legacy of this. Harriet, just a real quick, any updates on what's happening in the Washington governor's race? It got certified. What's the old saying? Is the fat lady sung or whatever? I mean, is it over?
That was one of the political tunes over the weekend, that the image of the fat lady getting a little message that it's okay, you can start singing now.
Uh-huh.
But so far, nothing. You know, they did call for a revote to the tune of $4 million, and one poll says 60% of the people of the state of Washington approve of that idea, but, you know, they can pay for it if they approve.
You mean the Republicans?
Yeah.
$4 million is not a lot of money for the Republicans. They got $40 million for George's coronation.
That's true. But some of the letters to the editor coming in are pretty interesting from Republicans saying, Rossi, give up, quit. If it does go to another vote, you're not getting mine.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think that's something they need to consider too.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Harriet, thanks for the update. Good
okay,
to hear
take
from you.
Care.
Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's 16 minutes before the hour. This is where, going back to where we started at the top of the hour, when I was sharing with you this Baptist church that is virulently, toxically, sickly, mentally illly, whatever the adjective, the adverb there, homophobic. Well, it goes beyond that. I mean, these people are. Promoting, in my opinion, they're promoting murder. They're promoting acts of violence. I mean, when they showed up at the funeral of that gay kid down in Texas in '98, who was murdered because he was gay, and they showed up at his funeral with signs about, you know, how he was going to hell and all this kind of stuff because he was gay. I mean, this is, and 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, these guys were viewed the same way the American Nazi Party and Rockwell and all those guys, as the lunatic fringe, right? They're among us. We tolerate them because we believe in freedom of speech, but it's the lunatic fringe. My concern is that the lunatic fringe is taking over this nation, or perhaps has. Now, this specifically or directly doesn't have anything to do with the Westboro Baptist Church and their homophobic or anti-gay agenda, but in a way it does. Because in my mind, this is the same thing coming back. And that is the mentality that identifies a group of people based on some differentiating characteristic. That is, some in some way, these people are different than we are, right? Whoever the we may be and whoever the them may be. And therefore, that difference justifies excluding them from the rights and privileges that we have. This is not the American tradition. This is not the American way. I mean, you have now, you have this book by, what is her name, Michelle Malnick or something like that, out that is saying that it was just fine to inter the Japanese Americans during Pearl Harbor, or after Pearl Harbor during World War II. That, you know, it wasn't so bad in the camps, right? This is now entering mainstream American discourse. Why? Because of the right of because of the rise of right-wing media in the United States. And it is coarsening our public discourse, and it is causing us to accept government actions that someday may end up hitting us. Now, that's not the reason to object against them. But I think that we are in one of those Pastor Nehemiah moments, you know, where he said, you know, first they came for the, I don't remember his list, right? First they came for the Jews, and I wasn't a Jew. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a communist. And then they came for the communists, and I wasn't a communist. And then they came for the teachers, and I wasn't a teacher. And then they came for the churchmen, and I was a churchman, but by then there was no one left, or, you know, however he said it, much more effectively than I. I think we are at one of those moments, one of those turning point moments. This from the Melbourne, Australia Herald Sun. U.S. plans detention for life. Now consider, a life sentence is something that is not given lightly. A life sentence means your life is over. In fact, many would consider a life sentence to be a greater punishment than a death sentence, because living a tortured existence for many people is more difficult than dying. And here we have now this story. The Bush administration is planning for possible lifetime detention of suspected terrorists, including hundreds whom the government does not have enough evidence to charge in court. Citing intelligence, defense, and diplomatic officials, the Washington Post reported that the Pentagon and the CIA had asked the White House to decide on a more permanent approach for those it would not set free or turn over to courts at home or abroad. The Defense Department, which holds 500 prisoners at its base at Guantanamo Bay, America's first concentration camp, Camp X-Ray. The Defense Department plans to ask the U.S. Congress for $32.1 million to build a 200-bed jail to hold detainees who are unlikely to go through a military tribunal for lack of evidence, defense officials told the newspaper. In other words, you can't prove anything, you can't convict them, you don't have enough for a court of law, life in jail. You don't have the right to see a lawyer, you don't have a right to defend yourself. I'm telling you, the founders of this nation, from the conservatives like John Adams to the liberals like Thomas Jefferson, are rolling over in their graves. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly, so I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique. And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers.
Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
Female killer whales spend decades as grandmothers, and biologists wonder why. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Female killer whales tend to outlive their male counterparts by at least 30 years. The males usually die after they've passed their peak reproductive age, but female whales can live up to 50 years after they've stopped having calves. This dramatic gap in life expectancy has scientists wondering if grandmothers have a special function in social groups of killer whales. Linda Jones is a marine mammal expert with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Seattle. Jones says male killer whales mature around the age of 15 and they die in their 20s. But the females live much longer, and they live long after their prime reproductive years have come to an end.
Females mature at about 13 to 15 years. At about 40 years, they no longer reproduce. But there are females that are over 90 years old, so they can live a very long time in this post-reproductive phase. Why would a society have these post-reproductive females? What do they contribute to the population?
One possible explanation is that these grandmothers help raise the young. Jones says post-reproductive females in other species fill that role, but this has not been studied with killer whales. People don't know for sure why the grandmother whales stick around for so long, but Jones says it's important to figure that out. Some populations of killer whales are declining. She says the old females might provide clues about how pods of killer whales function and survive. That information might help people do a better job of protecting these marine mammals. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
It doesn't matter what they do. All that matters is my relationship to you.
And welcome back, my friends. A couple of folks in the chat room now have asked about the mouse today. We have a mouse outside our studio window. Yeah, he's been there's actually a sheer rock wall that goes up just next to the building and up about 180 feet up to the top of the hill here. And there's some steps that go up to the second floor that are outside. And just underneath the steps and through the snow that's on top of the snow, this mouse has been running up into these piles of leaves that nobody ever got around to raking. and picking out seeds and whatnot and munching on them for the last few days. I haven't seen him today. It's been raining here in the People's Republic, so the snow is covered with ice. It's very, very slippery. So I'm assuming the mouse is in his little mouse hole. So, and we still haven't named him. A leading Republican senator yesterday condemned as a bad idea a reported U.S. plan to keep some suspected terrorists imprisoned for a lifetime. So we have now Richard Lugar saying it's a bad idea, so we ought to get over it, and we ought to have a very careful constitutional look at this. I nominate him for our second Caught You Doing Something Right for the day, although I don't have my... Do I have my music up? Oh, there it is. Okay, we'll just... for Senator Richard Lugar... Well, no, was that it? Ah, there we go. Yes, there you go. Senator Richard Lugar, good on you for challenging this. Jeff in Denver has some thoughts on this or some other topic. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi. Talking about how our nation has changed, how your Caligula analogy.
Yeah.
The racism that's emerging here, that we think we're such an advanced nation, it was amazing to hear recently, a friend who does airport inspections. He was complaining about how much he has to inspect, and he said the bleeping dot heads. And, of course, first of all, just to hear the prejudice at all is stunning. But then he was even misplaced. It's not even he's talking about the wrong group, and we tend to group anyone who's different.
What's a dot head?
Hindu.
Oh, yeah, the dot in the forehead.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
what he meant was the raghead, which is the epithet for Muslims.
We had another
Arabs.
Friend recently talk about tall heads, and I complained about that. And I was talking to a friend. He goes, "Oh, I hear that all the time. He's in the Bible Belt."
Yeah.
And
yeah.
This is the world. He hears the tall head reference often.
This is the point. I mean, whether it's anti-gay sentiment, anti-race, it's just this. It's being it's not just being tolerated. It's being celebrated in some circles in our media in. The Michael Savage and whatnot, and in our government, in our press, we just can't have it. Jeff, I got a boogie. It's the end of the show. Thanks for the call, though. I do appreciate it. Well said. Thanks to Louise for producing our show today. To Rama Schneider for coming in and engineering it. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to Shelby on RadioPower.org for streaming us around the world. Folks at CRN, Ben Birch at White Rose Society, and to you. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vivionik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, "Whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it." And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show absolutely without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE.